was Mama Monster. That's how stupid. I can't help it.
This. I'm gonna keep the recording until you say it. So.
Okay, wait a minute. I gotta compose.
You've got to get through it, or we're never gonna be able to do this.
I have to compose myself. Wait a minute. Okay.
Jesus. But no, happy Mother's Day.
Thank you.
I love you.
I love you,
you
too.
You are the best.
Thank you very
now,
much.
Now get out of here. I have a show to do.
Hey, this is Mama Monster, and you're listening to the Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
I love you, Solo!
Mama Monster.
Conquered!
I want your soul.
You like fighting a woman?
You got grown-ass wrestlers in the back going on Twitter.
Come over here and threaten me.
Is that Pat Patterson?
You have legs.
Holy mackerel, did he get fat?
I was 99% positive it was just chest up.
No.
I want out of my contract if I don't get what I want!
Welcome to episode 912 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off here for Mother's Day Sunday, May 11th, 2025. I am the Solo Monster. Always good to hear Mama Monster's voice in that opening intro from still my favorite episode of the show when I had her on episode 495. That was 8 years ago. She's been gone now for 7 years. So this is always a very bittersweet day for me, as I'm sure it is for many of you listening. But for those of you who still have your mom in your life, cherish them because they will not be here forever. And I hope you have a very happy Mother's Day, all the moms out there. You know, if you want to feel old, 23 years ago this week, WWF got the F out and changed its name to WWE, which means they have now been WWE longer than they were WWF. That is just wild to me. But they'll always be WWF to me. And I know to a lot of you as well. I had a very busy weekend. House of Glory had a waging war show in Chicago at Logan Square Auditorium on Friday night. So I had a very early flight out of New York to Atlanta with a layover and then from Atlanta to Chicago. So I didn't get to spend too much time in Atlanta before I made my way up to the Windy City for what ended up being an excellent show. We had Mike Santana defending the HOG World Championship against the debuting Cedric Alexander. His very first post-WWE date was with HOG. And they had a banger of a main event. Zilla Fatu defended his Crown Jewel Championship against Matt Riddle. And we had Indy Hartwell and Miyu Yamashita. They were scheduled for a match on this show. This was Indy's second appearance in an HOG ring. Her first time was against Mercedes Moné a few months ago. And I teased during the week that I might have a special announcement on this show. And so I was out there with the HOG Women's Championship in my hand just before this match to make the announcement that Megan Bain, who had been the HOG Women's Champion for 287 days, the most dominant women's champion that we have ever had, and a fine champion, was unavailable. She was unable to compete. And again, you know, people reading things into it, it's more just a scheduling issue than anything else. It's nothing terribly serious. We hope and expect to have her back at HOG at some point. We look forward to that. But, you know, we got to move the train along here. And so the HOG Women's World Championship was vacated. And I was there to make the announcement that instead we would have a new women's champion crowned that night between Indy and Miyu, which was a nice surprise for the live crowd. They didn't know when they bought their ticket that they were getting a women's title match on this show. And so I sat ringside. I had a front row seat there at ringside to watch what was a very good, very enjoyable, very hard-hitting match between Indy and Miyu. And Indy Hartwell picks up the win and becomes the brand new HOG Women's World Champion. It was a very cool moment for her. It was very cool for me to be a part of that moment. But she's going to be a fine champion. We will have her back for our Texas debut, which is coming up on July 11th. So it was a fun night, and the next event will be June 7th. It's going to be back in New York at the NYC Arena for the second annual Mike Santana's Puerto Rican Weekend. And so that is going to be a very busy day, obviously. There's a lot of wrestling that day because June 7th is the same day as Worlds Collide that afternoon. which is the first NXT AAA joint show. And then that night is Money in the Bank. So I may not be live for Money in the Bank that night. I got to figure out what I'm doing. It's going to be another very busy weekend. But my thanks to everybody who came out on Friday. I got to meet a lot of very cool people. Sorry I missed some of you, but hopefully we will be back in Chicago at some point in the fall. As far as here today, we got to talk about Backlash last night, and I've got some other news and notes, including some sad tweet stuff to get into and a bunch of your mailbag questions. No Dark Side of the Ring review this week, as I was away and I was otherwise occupied. I just did not have time to get it done, but I will get reviews out for the Eddie Gilbert episode and the Billy Jack Haynes episode. You just got to bear with me on that. It's funny. I retire from the PR job, and yet I find myself busier than I was before. It's funny how that works. But thank you to everybody who dropped a PayPal donation this week. You may do so on thesolemonster.com if you so choose. The link is right there at the top of the page. It goes directly to the Solemn Monsters inbox, and I'll get all your information. $10 or more, I will give you a nickname and a shout-out here on this podcast. And we begin roll call with Big B, Brian Becerra, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, the Portland Pop Star, Paul Hamilton, Night Stalker, Nayef Alsafar, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard. Yeah, I'm sorry I missed you guys on Friday. I did spot Mama Eichard in her Sound Off shirt on the broadcast, and I shouted her out on Triller. So shout out to Willie and to Mama Eichard. The Wichita Workhorse, Clayton Nettleton. Clayton, I hope you have a good week as well. Killshot Keith Hart, thank you for the double shot. Raj, Must See Makwana. Sherrod Big Daddy Boyd, I want to give a shout out to him and to Jessica, who says she tried listening to another wrestling podcast, but it could not compare to yours, she said. I did not make it 15 minutes. Well, I hope that's a lesson learned for you. We all make mistakes. Thank you, Jessica. Shout out to Charbel, who's been a loyal listener of the Sound Off for well over a decade. Never misses an episode. He celebrated a birthday on Thursday, and his girlfriend, Yasmina, who also listens to the show, thought it would be cool to surprise him with a shout out here. I think so, too, Yasmina. I think that's a great idea. Charbel, I hope it was a great birthday. Thank you both for being fans of the show all the way from Lebanon. And they've gotten all their wrestling friends to listen as well. She says, I've got a fan club there. I love hearing that. And finally, congrats to the Kinnison family down in Spring, Texas. Daniel emailed me with a photo of their bouncing new baby boy named Maddox Oliver. You know, Maddox is a pretty cool name. He said Maddox listened to my Dynamite review on his way home from the hospital last week. See, baby's first podcast. If it was last week's Dynamite recap, I'm sure it put him right to sleep. But congrats to Daniel and his wife. Daniel's been a fan of the Sound Off for 10 years now. So it's nice to see the Sound Off family expanding. Last night, WWE hosted Backlash from the Enterprise Center in St. Louis, Missouri. It was a cool 2 hours and 45 minutes. So it was a very easy watch, and on the whole, I enjoyed it. I thought it was a good show. It felt very much like, almost like a modern day In Your House. Remember those In Your House shows? They were even shorter than that. They were usually about 2 hours until they expanded to three. But they were like 2 hours long. They had four or five matches on there, you know, maybe not even five. And they charged them, they priced them lower than your typical WWF pay-per-view back then. But they were usually an easy watch. Many of them were not as good as the show last night. And some of them were better. But that's kind of what it felt like to me. This is almost like Triple H's, like, In Your House, in a way, the way he formats some of these shows. But there was not a bad match on the card. Some were better than others, but there was not a bad match on the card. And that includes the main event, which I was very iffy about, because I knew that they were hyping this up as the last match ever between John Cena and Randy Orton. They're in St. Louis, Randy Orton's hometown, so you knew the crowd was going to be hot for him. They were going to likely, hopefully, be hot for the main event. But then the bell would ring. And so what kind of match are we going to get between these two? Because for all the talk about what a classic feud and rivalry these two have had over the years, it doesn't matter how many times they say that and how many times they tell us that. They really make it out to be more than what it was. They had some great matches together. I'm not saying that every match they ever had was a dud. But it's really not like the classic feud that they build it up to be. But John Cena is also not the in-ring performer that he used to be. And you're going in there in the main event against Randy Orton, who already works a very slow, methodical pace, which is the pace that Cody Rhodes had to bring himself down to when he was working Cena at WrestleMania this year. But I'm happy to say that this was actually a better main event. This is a better match than the night two WrestleMania main event that Cody had with John Cena. Even with, you know, another nut shot and a belt shot, it was a very similar finish. But how we got there, you know, the journey to the destination was a lot more fun than what we got at WrestleMania. Which really should never be the case. But that was certainly the case this time. They went out there and they had the best possible match I think that you could ask for out of John Cena and Randy Orton in 2025. There was a lot of smoke and mirrors. There was a lot of finisher spam and ref bumps to the point of absurdity. But they put together what overall was a fun match, as fun of a match as you're going to get, honestly, out of those two. And the crowd was hot for it. It was the right place to do it. It was the right atmosphere for it. John Cena is still the WWE champion. And the question now turns to who's next for John Cena. I'm going to talk more about that main event here in a little bit. Let me just start from the top here. Just a quick overview, some quick thoughts on this. Again, the full review, the full video, and all of your questions and a couple of Be the Booker rounds we did last night as well. It's all up on the YouTube channel right now if you missed the live stream. But they had a fatal four-way for the United States Championship. It was Jacob Fatu defending against LA Knight, Drew McIntyre, and Damian Priest. Drew McIntyre had a very good case for being pissed off about this because you had an LA Knight and Damian Priest, two men who lost at WrestleMania. And Drew McIntyre actually won his match against Priest at WrestleMania, and he went on to beat, albeit by DQ, but a win is a win. He got a win over LA Knight on SmackDown a few weeks ago to become number one contender. So if you're Drew McIntyre, you're looking at this and saying, why the hell do I have to wrestle in a fatal four-way match when I should have this guy one-on-one? So he definitely has a point there. He made that point on SmackDown on Friday night. But these four went out there, and the crowd was very hot at the beginning of the show. It was all action. You know how these four ways are. It's basically tornado style, one fall to a finish. I thought it was a very good opener, but it built to the debut of a brand new superstar that we have not seen in WWE before. This is where they chose to debut Jeff Cobb, who had quite the odyssey getting to St. Louis for this show. Mike Johnson on PW Insider reported last night that Cobb is believed to have been on somewhere in the area of 4 to 5 different flights, starting in Japan over the last day and a half, and finally ending up in St. Louis yesterday morning, with WWE officials taking extensive precautions to prevent leaks about his surprise appearance. I wonder if when he was traveling on these flights, maybe he was wearing the Matanza mask from Lucha Underground, although I guess that would have been a dead giveaway. If there are any Lucha Underground fans who would have happened to be on the same flight with him. I mean, I thought I had a pretty miserable day on Friday, but 4 to 5 flights in a day and a half starting from Japan just sounds like a nightmare. But it paid off for him because he made his debut in a pretty good spot. And when they showed him on camera, he got a really good reaction from the fans in St. Louis. There were enough people in that venue that knew who he was, even though he has never been in WWE before. He got a really good reaction. It was Solo Sikoa basically bringing him out to help out Jacob. And Jacob looked like he had no idea this was going on. He had a very confused, almost maybe distrusting look on his face when he saw what was going on. And they said, it's all you, brother. There he is. LA Knight was in the ring. And so Jacob went and finished him off with a mighty moonsault. And he remains the United States champion. And now the addition of Jeff Cobb adds some new life to Solo's bloodline, which was really lacking. And this is why I wonder if this is the reason why Jeff Cobb was added to the group in the first place. Because they have nobody else. Tonga Loa has been out with an injury now for months. Tama Tonga just went down with an injury. He's also expected to be gone for a while. I mean, that was the bloodline right there. It was Solo, Jacob, and the Tongans. And the Tongans are gone. So that leaves you with Jacob and Solo, who have felt like they're very much on the outs if they want to keep this story going. And let's be honest here. I mean, the bloodline will never die. Whether it's Samoans or Tongans or basically any island boys they can add to this group, the bloodline will continue on in some form or fashion indefinitely. They chose in this case to add Jeff Cobb, who I don't believe has any actual Samoan blood in him. And so Hikuleo will have to wait. Hikuleo is in shambles somewhere down at the performance center. He'll have to wait for another day, as will Lance Anoa'i. But in the case of Jeff Cobb, I think it was just a matter of we lost these two guys. We're not ready to end this story and end this group yet. Who can we add? You know, Bronson Reed. Somebody pointed out Bronson Reed last night during the review. I had forgotten, you know, he was with them in War Games last year when he got hurt. And those few weeks where he had basically joined the bloodline in the lead up to Survivor Series, he looked like a really good fit. Like, he fit like a glove in that group. I don't know if the plan was to keep him in the bloodline after Survivor Series on a more permanent basis, had he not broken his ankle. I don't know if that was the plan, or maybe he would still be kind of loosely associated with them, or maybe he wouldn't have been associated with them at all. He would have been a good fit for this group. He also was out hurt. I don't know when he's expected back. Cobb got the call. Wouldn't be shocked if that's why he got the call to be in this spot. Now, he also debuted as Jeff Cobb. They called him by that name. Michael Cole identified him as such on commentary, called him one of the hottest free agents in all of wrestling. But also, there was a very interesting trademark filing just yesterday, the very day that Cobb debuted. WWE filed to trademark the name JC Mateo under entertainment services related to wrestling exhibitions, fan club services, and sports entertainment information. And apparently Big E on the post show referred to Cobb as a man once referred to as Jeff Cobb, even though on the actual PLE they called him Jeff Cobb. They referred to him by his actual name, but I think that this trademark filing could be an indication that that name still may change. So he may not be Jeff Cobb on a permanent basis if this JC Mateo name is any indication. But again, I feel like we went through this with, was it Jacob? You know, Jacob debuted and they identified him as Jacob Fatu. But I want to say there was a similar situation where there was a name that was trademarked and people thought, well, this is probably going to be the name they give him. And then they didn't. So who knows? I mean, who's to say that, you know, they just trademarked the name for someone else, or they trademarked it in the event they decide to use it for him. But the way I look at it, you identified him as Jeff Cobb already on TV. That's his fucking name. Just let him use the name. You know, there's no reason to make a change at this point. But very good opening match. I enjoyed it a lot. The U.S. title scene on SmackDown right now is really cooking. Yeah, they're cooking with oil. They have Jacob as the champion. You got LA Knight, Drew McIntyre, Damian Priest. Who knows how Solo and or Jeff Cobb may factor into that. Aleister Black just debuted. Carmelo Hayes is on the show if they ever decide to push him at a serious level. So there's a lot of people who are either in contention or could potentially be in contention for that title. It's a very busy scene as compared to the Intercontinental picture over on the Raw side right now. And speaking of the Intercontinental title, we have to talk about the women's Intercontinental title, because Becky Lynch and Lyra Valkyria had their first match since their NXT days, and they went out there and they killed it, and they had what I thought was an excellent match. And I'm a little torn on the opener or the women's IC as the best match on the show. I gave the nod to the women's match, but if you were to tell me that you thought the Fatal 4-Way was better, I wouldn't argue with you. I go with the ladies, though. And so it was an excellent start to the show between these first two matches. Easily the best match that Lyra has had, not only since winning the championship, but even just coming up from NXT. This was the best match that she has had so far in her WWE run. And Becky Lynch, though, did not win. I was very surprised that they did not put the championship on her, pleasantly so. I do think there's a decent chance that title will still end up around her waist. This was certainly not, when this ended, done in a way that would indicate that this feud is over. Let's put it that way. And they have Saturday night's main event coming up on May 24th. And very much could see a Becky-Lyra rematch on that show for the championship, where either Becky wins the title there, or Bayley makes her return as she costs Becky, and then they go off and they have a match. But this is why I said it was smart to get Becky involved here. And some people will roll their eyes, oh, you know, Becky Hogan, or why does Becky need to be involved with this title? And people have made similar suggestions about Charlotte Flair, you know, and they don't want to see Charlotte Flair competing for the Women's World Championship. And after their WrestleMania match, I certainly have no interest in seeing Tiffany and Charlotte extend their feud. So then what does Charlotte do? Well, maybe she goes after the United States Championship. Does she need it? No. Could the title use it? Yes. I just have no interest in seeing Becky and Charlotte simultaneously holding the women's mid-card belt. So I just feel like if you're going to do it with one, you shouldn't do it with the other at the same time. But I would actually have no issue with the right story, you know, putting the U.S. title for a little bit on Charlotte at some point, because it would keep her away from Tiffany and the world title. And for the same reasons I suggested it for Becky, it would help elevate that championship. Charlotte is very hated right now. And so lean into that, you know, heat that she gets. And have her hold the mid-card title for a while and, you know, work with people that she maybe wouldn't ordinarily work with. I wouldn't really have an issue with that. Just not at the same time that Becky would hold the IC title if she were to beat Lyra for it. But just by virtue of Becky even being in this match, you know, I pointed out last night, this championship was decided, I believe it was January 13th, right? It was the second week of Raw on Netflix. And Lyra beat Dakota Kai in the finals of the tournament to crown a brand new champion. Since that time, there have been a handful of PLEs. This was the first time that the women's intercontinental title, I think either of the women's mid-card titles, was defended on a PLE. The only reason that happened is because Becky Lynch was in this match. So just by virtue of Becky challenging for it, it got more attention than it would ordinarily get. It would not have otherwise been in this spot. If it wasn't this match in this spot with Becky in it, we would have had probably the tag match, honestly, that we're getting on Raw tomorrow night with Rhea Ripley and Io Sky against Julia and Roxanne Perez. That match probably would have gotten the spot on this show. Either that or Tiffany Stratton defending her title against Nia Jax, since Nia is the number one contender now. But that just goes to show you the power of having somebody with a name like Becky being in this spot. So not only did it get Lyra a match on this show, but Lyra beat her. Not decisively. You know, they were trading rolling cradles or roll-ups back and forth, and Lyra got the better of it. And when the match was over, Becky put her in to disarm her. Lyra was favoring her nose more than her arm. She was holding her nose because Becky, it looked like, tagged her with a shot there towards the end. Michael Cole said, oh, her nose might be broken, which I don't think it was, but it was clearly bothering her. And so now we wait to see, you know, when they do the next match. Saturday night's main event sounds about right to me. But I thought these two went out there and they killed it. So on the men's side, the Intercontinental title was on the line. We had Dominic Mysterio defending against Penta. It took five men conspiring to defeat Penta. I don't want to hear, well, he's buried now. That's the end of the Penta push. He's buried. He lost to Dom. No, he didn't lose to Dom. He lost to Dom. He lost to Balor. He lost to JD McDonough. He lost to Carlito, who was out there running distraction. And he lost to El Grande Americano, who used the loaded mask to knock out Penta, which paved the way for Dominic to hit a frog splash and pick up the win. And I should mention El Grande Americano, the brand new speed champion. He won the title. That match was taped on Cinco de Mayo and then aired on X on Wednesday. So he got his first taste of gold. But yeah, it took five men to beat Penta. So before we declare his push dead, let's just wait a little bit, okay? Let's not be premature. People love throwing that word around. What I'm wondering is, you got that World's End, not World's End, you got that World's Collide show coming up on June 7th in Los Angeles. And do we get a Lucha Brothers reunion on that show? Because Rey Fénix lost to El Grande Americano much the same way at WrestleMania. So do we get Penta and Rey Fénix for one night only as tag team partners, which would be a nice hook for the show. But then who do they wrestle? It could be El Grande Americano and someone else. You know, who would that other person be? Maybe El Grande Americano and Dominic are tag team partners. But I think getting the Lucha Bros together on that show would be a nice hook for that World's Collide show. And that may be where they're headed. But Dom looked good in this match. You know, he busted out a suicide dive into a DDT that looked great. And I can't remember him using that move before. So, you know, he looked good. But I said, you know, the streak was over. I said, you know, the first two matches were two for two. And then the streak was over because it was fine. But, you know, it felt like a TV match. And it had a very television match type of ending. So it wasn't anything great. You know, it was a fine match, but really I wouldn't say it was much more than that. But then we got to Gunther and Pat McAfee, which was actually the match I was most looking forward to on this show, because I was very interested to see what is Gunther going to get out of Pat McAfee. It's been some time since we've seen Pat in the ring. He's not a wrestler, even though he's wrestled before. But he's a commentator. He's not a wrestler. We know he's an athlete. We know he's wrestled before, and he's done stuff off the top rope. He had some good matches, too, especially in NXT. But it's been some time. It's been years since those matches. Gunther is one of the best in the world right now. The guy knows who he is, that he comes out there and just with that big smug look, at fucking grin on his face, he just looks like the biggest bastard in the world. But you know what? He can be smug and cocky because he knows how good he is. And he's been a world champion and an intercontinental champion. He's been a champion for 80 to 90% of his time on the main roster so far. And even when he was in NXT, in NXT UK, he was a champion there for a good amount of time too. So if anybody was going to be able to pull Pat McAfee to certainly one of the best, if not best match of his career, this is the guy to do it. You know, this is the dance partner that you want to have. And I said, this match should not go very long. It's not going to go 2 minutes like some people wanted it to. You're going to have a match here where Gunther plays with him and toys with him, and you give Pat some hope spots. He's very well liked by the audience. It'll get the crowd up. You'll have Michael Cole on commentary rooting for Pat. But then in the end, Gunther will extinguish whatever comeback he makes, and he'll put him down as he should. And that's basically what they did, but it took 14 minutes to get there. Now, I can't really argue with what they did because the crowd was super into it. They ate it up. Every time Pat would try to make a comeback, they were rallying behind him, and then Gunther would put him back down again. I think it would have been better for this to not go 14 minutes. I think you could have shaved a few minutes off of this. There were some times where Pat was making a comeback and, you know, Gunther had a sell for him, and I'm just like, I was like, okay, I'm biting my tongue here, but the basic match they worked was exactly what they should have done. And then in the end, Gunther puts him out with the sleeper hold. Michael Cole did get involved in the match at one point. They actually had a great spot that had me just, I'm sitting here going, oh my fucking God, they're really going to do this. Where they had Michael Cole grab Gunther by the leg as he was trying to suplex Pat back into the ring, and Pat fell on top of him. And Cole was holding the leg down, and the referee didn't see it as he began to count. And I thought that might be the finish. And that's how Bobby Heenan helped Rick Rude win the Intercontinental title at WrestleMania many years ago. And still, Gunther managed to kick out of it. So it was one of those, for me anyway, it was one of those convincing near falls that had me just, I was about to flip my shit. But thankfully, Gunther kicked out, and they did the right thing there on the finish. What surprised me a little bit was when the match was over, how he paid respect to Pat, kind of nodded to him as if he had gained respect from him, and then he left. And it shouldn't be that surprising, I guess, because that's just the kind of heel he is. We've seen him do this before. He did it with Cody Rhodes when he lost to Cody. I believe that was Night of Champions in Saudi last year. And he said something to Cody, and I think he shook his hand, and he left. So, you know, he's the heel where if you beat him, or even if you don't beat him, but you really put up a hell of a fight, he's not above, you know, paying you some respect when the match is over and giving you props. And that's basically what he did with Pat. And then he left. And when the show was over, Pat put a picture up on his Instagram of his chest, all red, beat red, after getting chopped by Gunther. And Gunther responded and said on his own Instagram story, he said, "Done and dusted." So it certainly feels like this is over. I mean, there really is no reason to continue this. He made his point. He won the match. And now he's moving on. But to what? You know, what is he moving on to? Because I still feel like all roads lead to Gunther and Goldberg, probably at SummerSlam in Gunther's retirement match, or God forbid, Goldberg, can you imagine Goldberg retires Gunther? Hey, you know what? Depending on how that match goes, if he picks him up for a jackhammer, he just might retire Gunther. But, you know, he's having his retirement match. Goldberg is Goldberg this summer. Gunther will probably be his opponent. beyond that, I don't know what's next for him, right? That, but if they do it at SummerSlam, that's still a few months away. Gunther may go away for a while. Maybe we don't see him every week on TV, but you got to have something for him to do. And he's just in this weird spot where he's not the kind of guy you want to move down the card too much, because he's always been a champion. He's always involved in something relatively big on these shows. Seth Rollins, though, is the one who is really tied up with Jey Uso right now, as far as the World Heavyweight Championship is concerned. And he lost the title to Jey Uso. We're not going back to Gunther and Jey Uso again. I really have no interest in seeing that anyway. We've seen it four times. Jey beat him. And when Jey loses that title, it will not be back to Gunther. But he's on Raw. He's not on SmackDown. And even if he was on SmackDown, he wouldn't be challenging John Cena for the WWE Championship. So he's out of the world title picture for the time being. The Intercontinental title on the Raw side is currently held by a heel in Dominic Mysterio. So there really is no obvious next feud for him. AJ Styles is on the show. He's actually wrestling Finn Balor on Raw this Monday. And I would love to see something with Gunther and AJ Styles. So maybe that's a direction they can go in, you know, before we get to Gunther and Goldberg, if that is the match. But yeah, he's kind of a weird one right now. I don't know in the interim what you do with him. You just have to handle him with care, because there aren't too many performers in wrestling right now quite like Gunther. And then in the main event, it was John Cena and Randy Orton one last time for the WWE Championship. This went nearly 30 minutes. And in some ways, it was an homage to their past matches. We had that RKO reversal spot where Cena went for an attitude adjustment and Orton hit him with an RKO on the way down. And I said, you know, I think they've done that once before. I just couldn't quite place what match they did it in. And then everybody mentioned the table match. They had a tables match on Raw. And it was many years ago, but yeah, they did use that spot once before. It was actually a good counter to the attitude adjustment. It felt like fans at first didn't quite know that he had reversed the move, because they were both laying there. They're like, wait, what just happened here? But it was a bit of an homage in some ways. There was a lot of smoke and mirrors. There was a lot of finisher spam. Especially Randy Orton was even using John Cena's finish, let alone his own finish. So there were multiple RKOs and multiple attitude adjustments, multiple punt kick attempts, which never quite connected. And they had the best John Cena-Randy Orton match, I think, that you could have asked for. It was not boring. It was not, I mean, it was slow in the early going, but I mean, they were doing a lot of different things, you know, and we had some table spots on the outside of the ring. There were multiple ref bumps, at least three ref bumps, and then officials ran in at one point to check on the referee, and Nick Aldis got an RKO, and all the agents, Shane Helms and Jamie Noble and Daivari, they all got dropped with RKOs. So there were bodies everywhere. And so there was a lot of that going on. And then R-Truth runs in just as Randy Orton is about to punt kick Cena in the head. Now, I talked about the possibility of this happening after the SmackDown episode, not this past Friday, but the previous week, where Truth had confronted Orton in the backstage area and said, you know, you're going to lose at Backlash. And John Cena told me so. You're going to lose to the last real champion. And it felt like this man was just completely brainwashed. You know, he's been portrayed as the biggest John Cena fan. John Cena is his inspiration now for years now. He's been jacking this guy's moves. And it was an interesting approach to take. And I thought, well, maybe we'll see Truth in the role of kind of the useful idiot for Cena, where Cena realizes, holy shit, I got this guy wrapped around my finger. I could use this to my advantage. And maybe we would see Truth involved in this match in some way. And sure enough, he was involved in the finish. And he ate an RKO as well. So we didn't get Travis Scott on this show, because I was fully expecting we're going to hear Fiend. And we didn't hear Fiend, but they had Truth run out there instead. He ate an RKO, and that's when Cena caught Orton with a low blow, the belt shot. He covered him. He got the pin, and John Cena retains the championship. The most interesting thing that happened, though, was after the match and after the show went off the air. It came back and they showed Cena leaving the ring, and he had this look on his face almost like he was very introspective. And he's looking down at the championship as he lays it out, you know, on the ring apron after he stepped out of the ring, and he's just kind of gazing at it, and the camera's right up there, like all up in his face. And he almost looked remorseful or regretful about his behavior, about the way he won the match, and maybe having second thoughts about the way that he's conducted himself. Like the old John Cena was trying to shine through, but he was trying very hard to suppress it. It felt to me like the planting of an early seed as we eventually will get the redemption arc and the babyface turn. Yeah, you know, we know it's coming, but hopefully not for many more months, because you got to do the CM Punk match first. So it was an interesting approach to take. And then at the post-show scrum, as I was streaming last night, they had the post-show scrum and John Cena came out. And he said that this time he was going to actually answer some questions, which he has not been doing. He had refused to do so previously. And before he was about to answer the first question, R-Truth interrupted. And he congratulated Cena, said he was proud of him, even if people were saying that he sucked and that he couldn't wrestle. And Cena slowly stood up, and he very calmly told Truth, if you say another word, I'm going to lay you out. And Truth just tried to explain what he meant, but Cena grabbed him, picked him up on his shoulders, and very casually dumped him onto the table and threw the table up on the dais with an attitude adjustment. And then Cena took his championship and he took his leave. And I was already thinking, you know, at the end of the show, before they even shot this angle, Cena's been advertised for Miami for Saturday night's main event at the end of this month. What match are they going to do? Unless they're just advertising him for an appearance and he's not going to wrestle on that show. But, you know, it's one thing for him to be on Raw or SmackDown and just make an appearance and not wrestle. But on a show like that, he should be wrestling. So who's he going to wrestle? And a rematch with Randy Orton is the thing that made the most sense. But honestly, I don't think you're going to get a better match between John Cena and Randy Orton than the one we got at Backlash. Like, I don't know why you would even want to run that match back. They went 27 minutes. And anything and everything they had left in there that they could possibly do to each other, they did. And we had, again, all the finisher attempts and the near falls. So what kind of match are you even going to get if you run it back again? It's not going to be as good as the one we got last night. So what's the point? And just for what? To beat Randy Orton a second time? But if you do John Cena against R-Truth, right, that's not a PLE match. But you could certainly get away with doing that on a Saturday night's main event. They already have a World Heavyweight Championship match announced between Jey Uso and Logan Paul, so it's not going to be the only title defended if they choose to have Cena defend the WWE title. You could absolutely do Cena and R-Truth on that show. And after what he did at the post-show scrum, it looks like that's exactly where they're headed with this. And I say, why not? I think that's fine. The question then is, what comes next? As with Gunther, what's next? Money in the Bank is the next PLE coming up for them. Main roster PLE. I'm not counting NXT Battleground or Worlds Collide. I'm talking main roster. We have Money in the Bank on June 7th. What is next for John Cena? Because you cannot have John Cena go back to being a babyface before you do one last match between John Cena and CM Punk. Not after that promo that Punk cut on Cena and The Rock coming out of Elimination Chamber. You have to do that match first, and that is a huge match to do. And honestly, of anybody, any of these potential opponents that we are talking about, Randy Orton, Cody Rhodes, R-Truth, anybody else you want to throw in there who might wrestle Cena between now and then, the one guy, because there's just a certain chemistry and magic that these two have when they're in the ring together, and we saw a little bit of it at the Elimination Chamber this year. The one guy who I think could get the best possible match out of John Cena, and the crowd also would have a lot to do with it, would be CM Punk. I really do. I think if Cena's going to have that one last great singles match, and I don't know who he's wrestling in his final match, that's yet to be determined, but it's CM Punk. But to me, that's a SummerSlam match, right? It's not a Money in the Bank match. Money in the Bank is about Money in the Bank. You're going to have two ladder matches on that show. And it feels more like we're headed for a tag team match with Punk and Roman Reigns joining forces to take on Seth Rollins and Braun Breaker. That feels to me like the direction here. So you do Cena and Punk at SummerSlam, but SummerSlam's beginning of August, right? We're still here in not even the middle of May. Who's next? What's next for John Cena once they get past this R-Truth stuff? I don't know, unless he just vanishes again. He's got about 25 or so appearances left to make. So I would certainly hope he's not going to disappear for a month and a half. I don't know who that next opponent is going to be. There are a bunch of names on the roster who I would like to see Cena work with one last time, even if just on TV. Sheamus is one of those names. AJ Styles is one of those names. Kevin Owens was one of those names. Obviously, that's not going to happen now. I don't know if any of those matches are going to happen. I don't know if John Cena is going to wrestle some of the newer guys. I don't know if we might see John Cena in the ring with someone from NXT. You know, I don't know. I don't know what opponents they have in mind for him or how many actual television matches he's going to have because he only has so many appearances left. Although if it's about 25-ish, I mean, that's a decent number. It's not like he's working a lot of house shows. So I would hope that we at least get the odd title defense with him on TV, you know, with the appearances that they have him, you know, for, committed to. The other thing also, WrestleVotes posted something last night, and I'm not sure why this just was being reported yesterday, because he linked to a video of a news report from WCVB out of, I guess, Boston, it would be, somewhere in Massachusetts. And it was a report that they did. It was really about John Cena's father, who's also been involved in the independent wrestling scene up there in New England now for many years. But it was about Cena. It was about his dad. They interviewed his dad for it. And it was a report from April 25th. So it's already a couple of weeks old. But at the very end of the report, when they cut back to the anchors in studio, the female anchor mentioned that John Cena will officially wrestle his last match in December. And we knew that. But she mentioned it will be at the TD Garden Arena in Boston in December. And right now they have no event listed publicly or scheduled publicly for the TD Garden Arena in Boston. So we don't know if that's going to be a TV event. We don't know if that's going to be a Netflix or Peacock special, which I think it should be. I think they should build an entire special, probably a streaming special, around John Cena's final match, like The Last Dance. You build a whole card around it, but the key attraction is whatever that last match is going to be for John Cena. So we know where it will be. It will not be Madison Square Garden. It will not be London, because Cena has said in the past he would love to have his final match in London. It's going to be in Boston. He's from West Newbury, which is what, like an hour outside of Boston? It makes sense. You know, it makes sense. And it makes sense for him to be back to being a babyface by then. But as far as the last chapter here of John Cena and Randy Orton, they closed it a lot better than I feared they might. It was actually better than a lot of matches they've had before. I still think my favorite John Cena-Randy Orton match is their I Quit match at Breaking Point. And then they had the Iron Man match, which I think might have been the very next month. Unless it was the following year, but I want to say it was also. I think Breaking Point was September 2009. I could be wrong, but I think it was Bragging Rights 2009. It was definitely 2009 or 2010. But they had an Iron Man match. That's 60 minutes. So 60 minutes of John Cena and Randy Orton. I mean, that's like, you don't know how that's going to turn out. And as I recall, you know, I remember thinking, man, this was actually a pretty enjoyable Iron Man match that these two guys had. Those two matches are my favorite John Cena-Randy Orton matches. None of the other matches they had outside of maybe the finish of that No Way Out match in 08, where Orton smacked the referee and got himself intentionally disqualified. It's a memorable finish. None of their other matches really stand out to me. They really don't. It's really just those two. Where this one will fall on the list of all-time great Cena-Orton matches, it's pretty up there, honestly. But I also think it's just a sign that this feud and a lot of the matches they had were not that great. We're not that great, honestly. And WWE will build it up as if it was something much bigger than it actually was in the annals of Austin and Rock and Bret and Shawn and some of these all-time great feuds, but I don't look at it that way. But I think if you were somebody who is of an age where you started watching wrestling around the time that John Cena and Randy Orton were on top and were feuding with each other, then to you, that's how you view it. Or if you were a new fan who didn't watch the product before and you came in when John Cena was the man and Randy Orton, you know, was the bald menace and they were feuding and having those matches together, that's how you look at it. Because you don't have that frame of reference to some of these other like all-time great rivalries in wrestling. So I think that's part of it also. There's a lot of people where it's a generational thing. If I was growing up as a wrestling fan in the late 2000s, I might feel the same way, you know, because I wouldn't know from Hulk Hogan and Randy Savage and the feud they had and Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels and Stone Cold and The Rock or Rock and Triple H or Undertaker and Mankind or any of these great rivalries that we've seen over the years. So no matter how much they talk this up as being one of the all-time great legendary feuds, I'm sorry, but for me, it was not. But as far as a way to cap it off, what they did at Backlash last night was as good as you could possibly ask for. This could have been very, very bad. Okay, just look at the match Cody and Cena had at WrestleMania. This was not that. This was much better than what they gave us at WrestleMania. Today's episode is sponsored by Factor. You know, we're heading into the summer weather soon, which means beach bodies, which also means there's never been a better time to start eating healthier if you're not already doing so. It's not just good for your figure, but your health as well. And you can make this your best season yet with nutritious two-minute meals from Factor. Eating well has never been this easy. Just heat it and eat it and give yourself more time to do what you want. Factor meals arrive fresh and ready to eat, making them perfect for any active lifestyle. Here in New York, you know, we're seeing days in the 70s, approaching the 80s soon. So get outside instead of prepping and cooking indoors. With 45 weekly menu options, you can choose gourmet meals that fit your goals. Choose from Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto, and more. Factor powers your day with satisfying breakfasts, on-the-go lunches, and premium dinners. Not to mention guilt-free snacks and desserts. See, now you're talking my love language. It's easy to savor more this spring. Factor meals pack in the flavor without all the fuss. Now, one of my favorite recent meals from Factor was the Ropa Vieja chicken thigh bowl. I love me some chicken. It was also a spicy sweet potatoes and peanut sauce meal with coconut rice and roasted green beans that was very good. But my favorite by far was the sesame teriyaki filet mignon. It's pretty mind-blowing that it takes so little time to prepare a meal this good. You don't just want to feel like you're eating healthier. You want to actually enjoy what you're eating. And this was delicious. They only take minutes to make, which is good for me since I'm streaming most nights, as you know. So I don't want to spend forever eating dinner, making dinner before I have to go to work. Factor takes care of that for me. And it can take care of it for you too, with this exclusive offer for Sound Off listeners. Get started at factormeals.com/solomonster50off and use code solomonster50off to get 50% off plus free shipping on your first box. That's code solomonster50off at factormeals.com/solomonster50off for 50% off plus free shipping. So this doesn't happen very often, but as I am sitting here recording this episode, I got a text message from a friend of mine with a tweet that I had to go verify to see if this was true. And unfortunately it is. So we have some breaking news here in the middle of the sound off. And this is from PWInsider.com, Mike Johnson. PW Insider is saddened to report that former ECW world champion Sabu, real name Terry Brunk, has passed away at the age of 60. A cause of death has not yet been disclosed. Sabu had just worked his final match over WrestleMania weekend in Las Vegas at the GCW Spring Break Show, defeating Joey Janela in a no-ropes barbed wire match. He appeared last weekend at the Tri-State Wrestling Alliance Reunion Show convention at the 2300 Arena, that's the former ECW Arena, which appears to have been his final public appearance. So that came out of nowhere. And I'm very sorry to hear that. 60 years old is too young. And it's just weird because I didn't see the show, but I was aware that he had just had his most recent match. I mean, I know that I think they were billing it as his final match against Joey Janela. And I remember he took that just brutal bump out of the ring because it was a no ropes barbed wire match. And he took this bump where he fell out of the ring and it was a hard fall. Like right on his head on the concrete outside. And I mean, he took some punishment in that match. And it really, it felt like he knew if this was going to be his last match, he was going to go out the way that he wanted to. You know, and he was going to go out doing what he loved and being Sabu. And he certainly did. But I was not expecting to hear about this news today. So I'm kind of at a bit of a loss right now. You know, Sabu... You know, when I think of Sabu, there's a certain small group of wrestlers that I think of when I think of the rise of ECW. I think of Sabu. I think of Taz. I think of the Sandman. I think of Tommy Dreamer. Those are really like the core names that come to mind. Then I think of Raven. I think of Terry Funk as well. But Sabu is part of that group of wrestlers that made ECW what it was, that made ECW as extreme as it was. And he will go down as one of the most influential wrestlers of all time. Now, there are different wrestlers that have had different influences on people over the years. Sabu definitely influenced a generation of wrestlers. And whether you want to say that was a good thing or a bad thing, because his style could be very reckless, you cannot say that he was not an influencer or a pioneer in the wrestling industry, because he absolutely was. And I was not watching ECW full time back then. Yeah, I was a WWF guy, and I would flip over to WCW sometimes. And the only time I would really catch ECW in those early days, and I'm talking, this is after they became, you know, Extreme Championship Wrestling. They were Eastern, and then they converted to Extreme. So like mid-90s, I would be one of those people here in New York who would be flipping channels sometimes if I was up, and 3 o'clock in the morning on MSG Network is when they would air ECW Hardcore TV. And he was one of the guys that would come up, you know, him and Bill Alfonso, and then later on, he had the tag team with Rob Van Dam. He had a pretty legendary feud with Taz. But I would see Sabu doing all of this wild shit. And it's, again, 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning. And he's out there and he's doing, you know, he did the Arabian Facebuster, and he was doing the triple jump moonsaults, and he was doing all these springboard moves. And rarely did it look pretty, but it got your attention, because you're watching this guy do all of this just wild, dangerous shit. And you're like, this guy's out of his mind. I don't even know if he knows what he's doing. He's just coming up with stuff on the fly and doing stuff. And again, sometimes it would be botched. And I think he would say, or people would say, that sometimes he would intentionally botch moves. And that's kind of one of the things he became known for as well. Like, it wasn't always pretty, and he would botch these jumps, but then he would go right back to it and do it again, and he would do this huge wacky dive out of the ring into the crowd, and it was just very violent, it was very extreme, so it was very apropos for ECW at the time. But he worked for every major company that you could think of throughout his career. I mean, ECW, obviously, but WCW, WWE. Like, it will never not be wild for me to think that he wrestled John Cena that one time. I know they had that one match. I want to say it was like a lumberjack match. And this was when they had the ECW revival. So around 2006. And there was a match between John Cena and Sabu. Like, you could not find two more diametrically polar opposite performers. And just to see them working together was just wild to me. So ECW, WCW, WWE, TNA, AEW. I don't think he wrestled a match, but remember, he made that appearance in AEW a few years ago. FMW for Onita, AAA, CMLL, New Japan, All Japan. I mean, the list goes on and on. Every major promotion in the last 30 or 40 years that you can think of, Sabu has worked there and performed there in some form or fashion. But I talked about like how violent the matches were that he would have. And I did a whole segment once, many years ago, here on the podcast for my This Week in Wrestling History segment. And I talked about the most violent match, probably most violent match in ECW history. And one of the most violent matches of all time is at that Born to be Wired event that they had at the ECW arena. And it was a barbed wire match with Terry Funk defending the ECW world title against Sabu. And the funny part about that is, if you just go by real names, it was Terry Funk against Terry Brunk was what the match was. But it's just a sick, twisted, just demented affair between these two. And nobody is going to look at that match and consider it like a Matt classic, because that's not what it was meant to be. It was violent. It was bloody. It was brutal. It's memorable for Sabu ripping his bicep open right down to the muscle. And Bill Alfonso is out there in his corner, and he's telling Fonzie, go find me some tape so I could tape this shit up and I can get back to the match. And he did. And Fonzie went to the back and he grabbed some tape, and they, you know, taped the arm up, and he continued the match. And there was a point where Sabu, he got crotched on the barbed wire, and he wrapped the barbed wire around his body, and he was, you know, doing dives wrapped in barbed wire and putting Terry Funk with a leg drop through a table, like crazy shit. even right down to the finish of the match, because both guys were wrapped in the barbed wire and they were so tangled up, all Sabu could do was hold his shoulders down for the three count. And when the match was over, they had to go find wire cutters just to cut them free because of how tangled up they were in the barbed wire. And they wanted Sabu to go to the hospital, and he said, no, like, you're going to stitch me up right here. Like, no anesthesia, no nothing. And it was something like 100 stitches or whatever it was to close the wound. And that's, you know, the famous story of him sending Fonzie to go find some super glue. And he did. He went to like a 7-Eleven or some overnight, out of bodega, whatever it was. And he got him a tube of just like some regular, like over-the-counter super glue that you would find in any store. And he's taping his arm up. Like, that's hardcore. That's what ECW was known for. And he was the pioneer of that. But that was... And I think he said this in an interview once, that that was the most painful injury of his entire career. And he's had a lot of them. Like, he put his body through the ringer to the point where it was sad, you know, in recent years seeing him. And even what little I saw of him in that last match with Joey Janela, he just seemed very out of it. I don't know what mental state he was in or what he was doing or drink. I don't know what was going on that day, but... He looked like he had no business being in the ring, but when he was in the ring doing what he was doing, he was in his element, right? Because this is what he did for a living. This is what he spent so many years doing. And, I mean, that match, though, that barbed wire match in ECW was so violent. Paul Heyman said that there would never be another barbed wire match in the company because he just could not subject anybody else to that level of brutality that we saw with him and Terry Funk that night. So that's one of many matches. I'm sure you're going to hear about it In the days and weeks ahead. There'll be tributes pouring into Sabu, and people are going to be recounting their memorable matches and moments of his career. There's an episode of Dark Side of the Ring, actually, this week, is on the original Sheik, and Sabu was interviewed for us. He's probably going to be all over that episode, and that's airing on Vice this Tuesday. So that's going to make that really depressing now to watch that episode. But somebody who certainly left his mark, not only on his body, in multiple places, he was all scarred up, but left his mark on the wrestling industry. You know, for better or worse, will ultimately be, you know, a subjective thing, and each person will have their own opinion on his style and what he contributed to the wrestling business. But one thing you cannot say is that he did not, you know, put his body out there every single time he went out to the ring, usually to his detriment. But he laid it all on the line every time you saw him out in that ring. And he will go down as one of the more memorable performers in history. And not only a pioneer of his style, but one of the guys who really brought ECW to the prominence in the mid to late 90s that it had. He was a very, very big part of that whole movement and that anti-authority rise, you know, in your face and blood and gore and guts and violence and all of that. But also an innovator in many ways. You know, you saw him do stuff out there, which really did legitimately look like he was trying some stuff on the fly just to see what he could invent and come up with. And he was very innovative in that way as well. You know, Tommy Dreamer was known as the innovator of violence. Well, you could use that same name for Sabu. So I'm very sorry to hear about his passing. But again, this is all breaking as I'm speaking here, as I'm recording this show. And my thoughts are kind of all over the place here, but those are my initial thoughts on the passing of Sabu. As more information comes out in the days ahead, I'm sure I'll be talking more about him on the Sound Off. So we move on from that. I just had a couple of other notes here. One on Io Sky, who had that incredible match at WrestleMania, her and Rhea Ripley and Bianca Belair for the Women's World Championship. One of the best women's matches in WrestleMania history, frankly. But there was a note in the Observer this week that one person high up in decision-making noted to us that Sky has been considered breakaway, or the breakaway star, this year, combining the fire and voice inflections that made Asuka a strong promo without speaking English and her ridiculously great work rate, and everyone loves working with her. So no one has a problem making her shine, letting her shine, and designing a match for her to shine. As they should. That's how it should be. Io Sky right now is one of the best performers in all of wrestling. And I'm not just talking male or female. Like, in WWE, she's number one right now. I mean, that's how good this woman is. And tomorrow night on Raw, she's going to be tagging with Rhea Ripley to take on Julia and Roxanne Perez. And speaking of Julia, that was the other thing I wanted to just make mention of real quick. Julia had a match with Jordan Grace on NXT this week that I did see, and holy shit. This was the first time that we have seen Julia in a WWE ring since she debuted last year, where she looked like the Julia of old. She looked like the Julia that you would see in Stardom. She had a match with Jordan Grace. She got dropped on her head not once but twice in this match. And Corey Graves, especially on that first one, Corey Graves reacted in a way that you would react not if you were a wrestling announcer trying to get like a spot over in a match. He reacted like a human being or a fan watching the show who thought this woman just got paralyzed in the middle of the ring. Like, he was beside himself, hands on his head. He couldn't believe what he had just seen. And for Julia, she just gets up like, okay, it's just another move. Because these Joshi wrestlers are just built different. And she's taken bumps like that and far worse back in her days in Stardom. So for her, it was nothing. But you had people on social media talking about how unsafe Jordan Grace is. And oh my God, I can't believe she dropped this woman on her head. I wouldn't be surprised if the match was designed specifically like that. You know, they went out there and said, hey, let's just go out there and do the deal. And they knew exactly what they were doing. And again, there was a second spot in the match where she got dumped, it looked like on her head, and turned out to be okay. But my God, like, where has this woman been? I'm not saying I want to see her dropped on her head, but even the rest of the match, like, they were laying in their shots. It was stiff. It was snug. And they had a hell of a match on Tuesday. And that's the version of Julia that a lot of people were hoping to see when she came to WWE. But I could also see a lot of women maybe not wanting to work with her for that reason, or not wanting to work that style. Jordan Grace obviously has no issue doing that. And so it felt like a fight. It didn't feel like they were, you know, just having any regular wrestling match, or they were, you know, cooperating and just doing big spots. It felt like a fucking battle between these two women. And it was great. And so we need to see more of that, Julia, with that fighting spirit going forward. But if you didn't see the match, it's definitely worth going out of your way to go check it out, especially if you were a fan of her work or familiar with her work before she came into the company. I think this is more along the lines of what you were hoping for when she signed. Let's talk about the WWE AAA relationship. There's been some updates on this. There was a report this week through reporting from the Spanish language publication Lex Latin. The percentage of WWE's controlling interest in AAA has been revealed. WWE, now owned by TKO, will own 51% of AAA when the transaction completes, which is not expected until the third quarter of 2025. With Mexican sports and entertainment company Philip owning the remaining 49%. The total amount of the sale has yet to be revealed. The report also indicates that the deal had a strong intellectual property component, as the main value of the acquired company is its intangible assets, including trademarks, copyrights, and exclusive use rights, among others. Because of this, the transaction required an audit of these assets to verify their specific characteristics, validity, and legal status, as well as a review of the licenses and other contracts entered into regarding them. Several of the seller's IP assets were subject to litigation, necessitating an analysis of potential liabilities and risks arising from the litigation. So basically, standard legal procedure. And if there were any sort of legal discrepancies or conflicts over wrestler names and things of that nature, then obviously the company is going to want to do its due diligence and make sure that that's either taken care of or it's taken care of before the deal closes. Now, on Monday, Ernesto Ocampo, the editor of Super Luchas, reported that Alberto Del Rio, who is the current AAA mega champion, and the following AAA talents have signed contracts with WWE: Hijo de Dr. Wagner, Hijo del Vikingo, La Parca, the new one, because they have a new La Parca now, who apparently is very good, La Hiedra, Lady Flammer, Lady Maravilla, and Nino Hamburguesa. According to Mr. Ocampo here, have all signed contracts with WWE. But then there was an update from Lucha Blog on Twitter that said WWE didn't, quote, give Alberto Del Rio a contract. In actuality, WWE is likely assuming responsibility for the contract that Del Rio signed with AAA last year. And they also noted that Ocampo will likely know more details about the contract statuses, but the situation was evolving since it was first announced last month. Additionally, Ocampo posted another update and said that the AAA wrestlers will be on the roster that will compete in Mexico. However, a few of them, like Vikingo, could possibly appear on joint events with NXT in the United States. Dave Meltzer later reported that Del Rio did sign a new contract with WWE, but he does not expect him to appear on WWE television, and he will be used exclusively on AAA events. So, for example, this World's Collide show that's coming up in LA on June 7th, I would not expect Alberto Del Rio to be on that show. Or at least that's the belief right now. Because people were freaking out about this. Now, let me get into some more here, because this is from Meltzer in The Observer this week. Nobody from AAA or WWE has commented on the report or responded to inquiries. One other person in the Mexican media backed the story. One person very close to some of the talent has disputed the entire story, particularly as it involves WWE signing contracts with anybody. One person with knowledge from WWE stated that they had never seen that list of wrestlers and said it was probably a legal formality on the AAA end. The Ocampo story was that they want to avoid what happened with Forbidden Door, where Stephanie Vaquer looked impressive in a match with Mercedes Moné, and they were legally able to sign her right away and not have to work in reverse, or have that work in reverse. Ocampo said that some may appear on NXT similar to TNA talent, but he thought it would only be a few people. He said many fans, especially in the U.S., are assuming that by buying AAA, WWE is also acquiring the contracts. But aside from the fact that the sale has not even been finalized, those contracts are of no use to WWE because WWE contracts are legally distinct and include multiple provisions and clauses such as exclusivity, intellectual property rights, and termination conditions that AAA's contracts do not address or enforce. That's why new contracts are replacing the existing ones. The AAA contracts are a joke. Any lawyer could invalidate them. WWE is offering contracts backed by TKO and including many clauses that AAA's do not account for. The idea is to sign only around 10 or 12 wrestlers from the current AAA roster. I don't know that the current AAA roster has that many more than that. Frankly, I don't think their talent roster is that big. But he also wrote that those on the list have already signed, and there are other contracts with AAA talent that are pending, along with contracts of talent they hope to bring over from CMLL. Others in Mexico said CMLL is fine with the WWE purchase of AAA because it leaves them as the only national promotion that will be doing Lucha Libre as it was done. AAA did Lucha Libre, but mixed in with hardcore wrestling and 1990s and 2000s American booking, such as heel authority figures and groups with the idea of taking from ECW and the NWO era in WCW. He said that for a few months there had been plans by CMLL to upgrade the booking and modernize the television production to compete with AAA, but this feeling has changed with the acquisition, thinking that AAA will not be viewed as authentic Mexican wrestling. That led to their new slogan that as long as Arena Mexico exists, Lucha Libre will never die. He said they are very excited about that slogan. Because CMLL is so entrenched culturally in being the oldest wrestling company in the world, there is the feeling that they will always exist. But in the U.S., many companies entrenched locally for decades still went by the wayside when WWE took over. Ocampo says CMLL also told the wrestlers that there will not be any changes in the booking approach or in their contracts. This announcement should have triggered immediate action to draft new deals, contracts that would have locked the talent in with better pay and clearly outlined dates with New Japan, Rev Pro, and AEW. But that's not going to happen. Incredibly, that's not going to happen. They're leaving themselves completely exposed to whatever WWE intends to do. The belief is that the June 18th AEW show at Arena Mexico will be like Forbidden Door in the sense that WWE will be watching, and the CMLL talent appearing on that show will be seen, and like with Stephanie, there will be an attempt to sign those that look impressive in their eyes. The Alberto name, and to a lesser extent, the, I don't know if it's Hiedra or Hiedra, I'm going to say Hiedra name, on the list raised some flags, and clearly the Alberto name caused negative social media and a favorable post on Lucha Libre Online, which is a website run by Alberto's good friend, Hugo Savinovich, that would indicate the response has raised questions. This is what Hugo said about his boy. Alberto Del Rio has no convictions against him. Alberto Del Rio committed no crime. The U.S. judicial system, one of the strongest in the world, found no crimes against him. Alberto Del Rio is drug-free. Alberto Del Rio only lives to take care of his children after the mother of his children left this earthly universe. There are no convictions. He came away free from everything. He matured. He reinvented himself. He's in respectable physical shape. He has a solid resume. He really wants to contribute to the growth of Mexican wrestling. He has filled arena after arena as the face of AAA. All the talents who have worked with him feel safe, and so does the production team. At the end of the day, he's an innocent man. We're not saying it. The U.S. judicial system says it. Stop the media war against him once and for all. This is the only individual who did a media tour with all the press and answered each and every question asked, no matter how uncomfortable they were. Everyone deserves a second chance. Let him bring bread to the table for his children, who only have him in their lives. So Alberto Del Rio has spent many years working in different promotions, right? WWE, he spent many years there. He had a run there for a while in TNA many years ago after he left WWE or was let go by WWE. He was in Lucha Underground, right? In AAA. And right now he's the AAA Mega Heavyweight Champion. He's basically the top star in the entire company. And there was a period of time many years ago where it felt like on a pretty regular basis, there was always something going on, some kind of conflict or fight that he was getting involved in. He was fighting people, or there were more personal things involving some relationships that he was in. The most high-profile one of them all, of course, was the relationship that he had with Soraya, right? The former Paige in WWE. And they were engaged at one point. And then there was another story after that relationship ended involving, I don't know if it was an ex-girlfriend. It might have been another ex-fiance. And this goes back about 5 years. And that was more serious in that he was charged with aggravated kidnapping and sexual assault. And I covered it at the time on the podcast. There was a police report. It was very, very bad. And the charges ultimately got dropped when the accuser would not cooperate with the case. And it basically disappeared. And the family, Alberto's family and friends, claimed that she recanted her story. And so from there, his career continued on. And, you know, he became a top heel in AAA. And they basically built the company around him. And he won the mega title from Nick Nemeth last summer. Now, the stuff with Soraya was bad enough, and she's talked about how he would trap her in a room for 6 or 7 hours at a time, and she would get her ass beat every couple of minutes by him. He was doing all these crazy things to her. Whatever you think of how toxic that relationship was, this was years later, after they broke up, when she started speaking up about this, because she didn't want to be shamed on social media. Right, or not shamed any more than she was probably already being shamed on social media for various things. And she really didn't want to be labeled as a victim, so she kept quiet about it. But then his name ended up back in the news, I think, for this other story, and she was probably asked questions about him, and so she was all of a sudden being very public and describing the different things that he did to her. It was not an amicable split, let's put it that way. Okay, so that's bad enough when you hear her talk about what he was doing to her when they were in a relationship together. But then you get that case with his former fiance, which was also very, very disturbing. And in case you forgot that story, you've never heard it before, I'll just pull here from this story. Del Rio was arrested in May of 2020 in San Antonio, Texas. At the time, his ex-girlfriend, who again, I think she may have been his ex-fiance, but story says his ex-girlfriend accused him of a sustained and violent assault after he allegedly confronted her over suspicions of infidelity. And it is something that, you know, what she was describing in terms of the whole sustained aspect of this is very similar to what Soraya was describing as far as, you know, her alleging that there were these prolonged periods of time that he would beat on her. But it says, according to police affidavit, she claimed that he slapped her repeatedly across the head. The allegations also included that he forced her to wear a dress and dance for him under threat that he would abandon her son in the middle of a road somewhere, or in the middle of the road somewhere, if she cried. Further details in the police affidavit allege that Rodriguez, which is Del Rio's real last name, bound the woman's hands with boxing straps, gagged her with a sock, and subjected her to hours of sexual assault, reportedly involving the use of various objects. He was also alleged to have punched her in the back. Officers noted that the woman displayed visible injuries, including bruises on her face, arms, legs, and neck, all of which were documented in photographs. Additionally, the accuser claimed Rodriguez destroyed her phone and laptop and attempted to set her passport on fire. Following an investigation, a grand jury indicted Rodriguez in October 2020 on one count of aggravated kidnapping and four counts of sexual assault. The trial was postponed several times, but was ultimately scheduled for December 2021. However, on December 10th, the Bexar County District Attorney's Office confirmed that all charges had been formally dropped due to the failure of a key prosecution witness, the accuser, to appear for a trial. As a result, the case could not proceed. He said, and this is Alberto now speaking later on about this, "It was a situation between myself and my ex-fiance. She later admitted to lying about the allegations because, quote, I wanted to hurt him. I wanted revenge, and that's what happened. Alberto admitted that he cheated on his fiance 10 days before their wedding in their own bed. He said, you can call me a disgusting man, but I'm no rapist, and I never kidnapped anybody." Now, he is talking about how she admitted that she lied and she wanted to hurt him and stuff. I don't even know, to this day, I'm not even sure about the validity of those supposed comments from this woman, where they came from, if she was on social media and had her own account and posted it there, or if this was just Alberto and his family putting that out, because the whole thing is very suspect. And again, there was a police report. There was documented evidence that something happened to this woman. And was he convicted of a crime? No, because she was not available to testify, I guess, for the prosecution. And so it was very difficult then to put a trial on if the person making the accusations is not available or is all of a sudden having a change of heart about this. This whole thing stunk to high holy hell, though, when I first read this. And the idea, like Hugh goes on there, oh, he's totally innocent. None of this stuff has ever been proven. He's totally innocent. Well, you know what? In the eyes of the justice system, sure, he wasn't convicted of a crime. But to believe that he's an innocent angel and that all of this stuff, to go even back to the Soraya stuff, that all of this stuff is just completely made up and manufactured. This is a man who has just been wronged each and every single time. He doesn't have a temper. He hasn't done any of this stuff before. I find it very hard to believe. So yeah, he's not in jail because you can't convict him on something if you don't either have the evidence or if the person that was going to speak about it is all of a sudden not willing to speak about it. But that doesn't mean that Alberto Del Rio is an innocent angel. That doesn't mean that there are companies that should not look at him with caution when it comes to potentially working with him and bringing him in, because there's a lot of baggage there, right? You can understand why a lot of these companies would have reservations about wanting to work with this man in the future. And those are not the only incidents he was involved in. I mean, earlier this year, he got into a physical altercation. It was at a AAA show. And he got into a physical altercation with fans in the crowd, and he got suspended for 6 months by the wrestling commission. So he can't wrestle. I think it's in Tijuana for 6 months. It's only in Tijuana for 6 months. He can't even wrestle there. And I think that suspension may be coming up in a few months. So that was the latest incident with him. It was quiet for a while, but that was the latest incident with him. But Hiedra, at one point, that was one of the other names on this list, had a restraining order against her as part of Stephanie Vaquer's case against Rogelio Reyes, her ex-boyfriend known in wrestling as Cuatrero, who is still awaiting trial. Cuatrero's brothers, Sanson and Forastero, are tag team champions and part of Alberto's top heel group. And the Stephanie Vaquer thing is a whole other disturbing situation. But as far as Alberto Del Rio, you know, when this news broke this week, I read it as, okay, either they're updating the AAA contracts and effectively converting them to WWE contracts for all the reasons that, you know, Ernesto Ocampo mentioned, that the AAA contracts are shit. And WWE, if they're going to be owning this promotion, 51% of this promotion, they're going to want all of the performers under WWE-style contracts with all of the associated legal language. So that's not really a big surprise. And Meltzer says, well, you know, Alberto did sign a new WWE deal. I just look at it as a formality. He's working for AAA. He's their top champion, right? He's their top star. So him not immediately being let go by AAA is not a shock, but the idea that people are freaking out because, oh, he's, you know, WWE signed him. You would think the man is going to be on Monday Night Raw this week. He's not. I don't think he'll ever be on Monday Night Raw or SmackDown. That's not what this means. But right now, we don't know what we don't know. This is still a very fluid, developing thing. This deal is not even done. This deal could very well fall apart at the 11th hour. The transaction has not closed. It's like when we found out that TKO was going to, you know, own WWE and UFC, right, under the same umbrella, right? And Endeavor was basically scooping up WWE. There are any number of things that could have gone wrong in the months that follow where that deal could have fallen apart. The deal didn't close until that September, I think. So there's a lot that could still happen between now and then. And until we get some more clarity on this, this is all just speculation and conjecture on exactly what Del Rio's role is going to be here. But him continuing on in AAA would have been expected. I don't know why people would be surprised about that, but this idea that, oh, I can't believe WWE has signed Del Rio and they're going to bring him back, like, I don't expect him to be back, right? You can't rule it out that he won't at some point appear on some kind of joint show, right, that happens to have NXT talent on. If they're doing like a formally joint show, like this Worlds Collide thing, who's to say for sure? But until we get some more clarity on this, it's not worth, you know, speculating beyond what I've just talked about here, because people were making this into a bigger deal than I think it really is. But as far as the AAA stuff is concerned, they did announce that there's going to be a Triple Mania show coming up on June 15th. And as far as we know at this time, WWE is sending Angel and Berto to be on that show. And Meltzer says, you know, fans hope for bigger names like Penta and Phoenix or Dragon Lee or Rey Mysterio, which would be tough unless he was just going to show up to just make an appearance because he just had surgery to repair his adductor muscle. But there's also rumors that maybe Joe Hendry and or the Hardys could be on that show. None of this is confirmed. So in the weeks ahead, we'll find out who will and will not be appearing on those shows. But the Alberto thing became a big story this week, and so I wanted to address that here. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Mental health awareness has become a big thing in recent years. I feel like we hear more about it now than we ever did 10 or 20 years ago. And that's a good thing. But there's still room for improvement. 26% of Americans who took part in one recent survey say they've avoided seeking mental health support because they're afraid of being judged. And when people hesitate to get the help they need, it doesn't just affect them. It affects their family, their friends, even their coworkers. This Mental Health Awareness Month, let's encourage everyone to take care of their well-being and break this ridiculous stigma that still exists about therapy and seeking help from others when you think you need it. Therapy offers a ton of benefits for your mental health, from coping skills to stress management, teaching you how to strengthen your existing relationships and remove barriers to you forming new ones. And it can also help you process past traumas in your life, no matter how big or small they may be. BetterHelp has, for more than a decade, helped match people with the right therapist from their growing network of more than 30,000 licensed therapists with a wide range of specialties. It's also fully online, making it convenient and affordable at a time when things seem to be getting increasingly unaffordable. You also don't have to feel committed to one therapist if you want to change to a new one for any reason. BetterHelp gives you the option to do that at no extra cost. We're all better with help. Visit BetterHelp.com/Solomonster to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Solomonster. Former WWE star Mike Drosy, better known as Duke the Dumpster Drosy, the wrestling garbage man, was in the news this week for all the wrong reasons. He's been indicted on child exploitation charges. In a press release issued on Monday, District Attorney General Chris Stanford of the 31st Judicial District of Tennessee announced that Drosy had been indicted on one count of attempted aggravated sexual exploitation of a minor. It was alleged that back on April 21st, Drosy used a Coinbase account to purchase child sexual assault material off the dark web. Stanford explained that while the transaction was flagged and terminated before completion, the intent behind the purchase elevated the case to an aggravated charge. Purchasing child sexual assault material is an aggravated crime because the money used to purchase the material is what continues to make child sexual assault material profitable for criminal enterprises, he stated. The case was first tipped off by Coinbase to the FBI. That tip eventually reached the Warren County Sheriff's Department on March 19th, prompting the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation to launch an inquiry. TBI agent Kevin Starr quickly built the case, leading to the indictment. Drozzi turned himself in after learning about the indictment and was released on $10,000 bond. He is scheduled to be arraigned on May 28th. The charge, a Class D felony, carries a potential sentence of 2 to 4 years in prison. At the time of his arrest, Drozzi was working as the DUI coordinator for the 31st Judicial District's Adult Recovery Court Program. He was immediately terminated from that role. Officials confirmed that his duties never involved working with children, and all court participants in the program are adults. This is not his first time in trouble with the law. It was in 2013. He was convicted of delivering controlled substances, including oxycodone, to an undercover informant while employed as a teacher. And he served 30 days in jail as part of a 3-year sentence and paid a $2,000 fine. And that's to say nothing of the stories about him allegedly drugging women with homemade GHB back when he was in his, whatever you would consider his prime wrestling days to be, I guess back in the mid-90s. But allegedly he was drugging women with homemade GHB by slipping it into their drinks and then doing God knows what with them, which I believe he got taken to wrestler's court for once after he was going around bragging about it. Should have been taken to an actual court, not wrestler's court. But Duke the Dumpster Drozzi, you know, he was one of those gimmicks, and he was, I think he was going by at least the name, the Garbage Man, before he even came to WWE. I'm sure that was the genesis of what we saw, you know, Vince put him on TV as when he came to the WWF. But, you know, that was back in a year, back in 95, where everybody had to have a second job. So you had the wrestling Garbage Man, and you had the wrestling plumber, and you wrestling dentist, and you had all of these ridiculous gimmicks. And he was among them. And he was actually one of Triple H's earliest feuds, was with Duke Drozzi, the man who once refused to do a job for Steve Austin when he debuted as the ringmaster. He said, I'm not doing it. But the last time he wrestled was for MLW in 2023 at their Battle Riot. I remember they did a spot where, oh God, who was it? Alex Kane, I think it was, put him in an ankle lock on his prosthetic leg, because Drozzi had his foot amputated many years ago. I think he got an infection, and he needed to have an amputation, so he got a prosthesis. Yeah, we just saw a fan hand Montez Ford his prosthetic leg during the TLC match on SmackDown a few weeks ago to use as a weapon. But that was hardly the first time that spot's been done, or any spot has been done with a prosthetic leg. You know, people think about the Shawn Michaels-Diesel match, A Good Friend's Better Enemies with Mad Dog Vachon. Then there was an angle in 2003 on SmackDown with Zach Gowen and Roddy Piper. But Drozzi had his own little spot there in MLW a couple of years ago. In any event, he will not be getting back in the ring anytime soon. Sometimes the trash just has a way of taking itself out. For sad tweet this week, I feel like it's been a while since I've done said tweet, but we've got a few candidates. First, we got to talk about Ricochet, and we got to talk about Javon Evans. Ricochet of AEW and Javon Evans of NXT. They got into it this week on social media, and it was all prompted when a fan asked Ricochet what he thinks about Javon Evans. And Ricochet quote tweeted his response and said simply, "I'd squash him." Well, Evans saw this, and he responded with a series of tweets that have since been deleted. The old tweet and delete, writing, "My bad, I just got done training at the Performance Center under Shawn Michaels, something that you don't have or do, but I bet yo brown egghead ass would squash me if Tony told you to. Much love, OG. Hashtag the young OG, hashtag Tupac of this generation." Is that what people are saying about Javon Evans, that he's the Tupac of this generation? Evans apparently took lessons from Ric Flair on tweeting the first letter of every word with a capital letter. But Ricochet later responded, "Brother, I was learning from Shawn Michaels when you was like 12, then went on to become multiple time champion. Let me know when you win one, little boy. And yeah, if Tony asked me, I would definitely beat your ass." I'm just reading it verbatim here. Okay, it sounds ridiculous. I'm just reading it. Okay. He later added, also, by just simply mentioning my name, this is your most engaged with post. You're welcome for the exposure, kid. So Evans then made a crack about Ricochet wrestling, quote, in front of 2,000 people after signing with AEW. This is what he wrote. You learned from HBK when I was 12 and became a multiple-time champion. Now you're wrestling in front of 2,000 people every week for a crackhead. Talk about an upgrade, am I right? Hashtag the young OG. But he wasn't done, although he should have been. He said, sounds like Mr. Khan isn't giving you enough attention, so you had to come for a successful ass youngin'. You're giving me the most views on my post, and I'm finally helping you get the most attention you've ever had in your career. All love. And Ricochet later fired back, how many people does the PC hold? Haha. But keep up the energy. It makes you look cool. I have no idea how or why this degenerated into what it did, all from a simple shit post by Ricochet, who was clearly tweeting as a heel. I mean, I was entertained by all this for all of 5 minutes, but the man got baited by Ricochet, of all people. Like, this is what he does on social media. He baits people with his answers. And Evans fell for it, hook, line, and sinker. I don't think it's very wise for Javon, as young as he is, working for a company that, as we were just reminded, has no problem releasing people en masse, to be calling the president of the second biggest wrestling company a crackhead. Because one day, he may be asking that crackhead for a job, and he may not like the answer that he gets. And I also don't get the whole wrestling in front of 2,000 people part from someone who routinely wrestles in front of crowds much smaller than 2,000 people. Like, they literally tape television every week in a building that probably doesn't fit more than 300 people. Like, what the fuck is this guy talking about? I don't know. I don't know. There's an arrogance to what he wrote that just made him look terrible. Like, we all say dumb shit when we're young. Hopefully for him, that dumb shit doesn't come back to bite him if he ever finds himself on the end of one of those releases, because that was very stupid. Then there's Shelton Benjamin, or should I say Benjamin Shelton. Not for anything that he said that was sad, but it's sad that it even had to be said in the first place, so I'm lumping it into said tweet here. So, let me read you from this story here. After Hulk Hogan called him by the wrong name multiple times in interviews, Shelton Benjamin has issued a response. A clip has been circulating on social media today with Hogan calling Benjamin by the name Benjamin Shelton while appearing on the Pat McAfee show and speaking with TMZ Sports. So, yeah, he did it twice, by the way. This was not like a one-time mistake. The latter appearance was to promote Hogan and Eric Bischoff's new Real American Freestyle organization, and Hogan named Brock Lesnar, Kurt Angle, and Benjamin Shelton as some of the amateur or collegiate wrestlers who have found success in pro wrestling. In response, Benjamin tweeted the following. Message to @HulkHogan. You lost me forever with your don't get caught, or as you would call it, apology speech. So rather than screw up my name and pretend we ever had any sort of camaraderie, which we never had, please do me a favor, and he included a gif of Will Smith at the Oscars telling Chris Rock to keep my name out your fucking mouth. MVP also responded to the clip of Hogan on Pat McAfee's show calling him a, quote, pathological lying piece of human excrement, end quote. Now, if you're wondering what Benjamin is referring to when he mentions the so-called apology speech, we have to go all the way back to 2018. There was a period of a few years, about 3 years, where Hulk Hogan was persona non grata in WWE. They let him go from whatever deal he had. They technically removed him from the Hall of Fame, whatever the hell that means, because the Hall of Fame is a fucking webpage, but they took his name off the webpage. So from that, people extrapolated that he was out of the Hall of Fame, which is very stupid anyway. But in 2018, they brought Hogan back. I guess they felt like enough time has gone by, we can bring him back. And again, why did they get rid of him in the first place? It all stemmed from the leaked tape of him making the racist comments and basically, you know, saying that he's a racist. I mean, go back and listen to or read his own words. This is right from the man's fucking mouth. No matter how much people want to sweep that shit under the rug, this is what he said. And the company knew they had to put some distance between themselves and Hogan because Hogan was toxic. And for the sake of the company, they didn't want to have anything to do with him. So when they brought Hogan back, I think they asked Hogan if, you know, he would speak with the black performers. And Hogan said no. He wants to speak to all the performers. So they brought him in. I don't remember what city they were in. Doesn't matter. But he was in the locker room and he gave a speech. And the crux of the speech, according to people who were there and heard him give it, was really him urging them to be very careful. Because everybody has cell phones and cameras now. And so they can pick up anything you say or do. And so there were people in that meeting who took it as Hogan being more concerned with being caught than actually being remorseful for anything that he said. And Hogan has said that he thinks that's an incorrect interpretation of his apology. Now, at the time, the New Day put out a statement and Titus O'Neil put out statements in the days after Hogan's so-called apology. New Day wrote that they were indifferent about him being back in the Hall of Fame and that they find it difficult to just forget when somebody makes racist and hateful comments, regardless of how long ago they were made or the situation they were made in. And they said their opinion on Hogan could change if he makes a genuine effort to change. Titus wrote that he, and again, who out there has ever had a bad word to say about Titus O'Neil for all the good that that man does? Titus wrote that he believes in second and third chances for people who show real remorse. But he was very critical of Hogan, saying that he didn't know he was being recorded when the racist comments were made. And he said Hogan's apology lacked true contrition, remorse, and a desire to change. So that is what Shelton's comment was in reference to. Good on Shelton Benjamin, man. This guy's going out there and saying his name wrong and acting like either... I don't know if Hogan was trying to portray it like he had some kind of camaraderie with him, which is what Shelton said, or if Hogan was just trying to act like he even knew who the fucking guy was. Meanwhile, he can't even say his name right. And that's two different interviews at two completely different times, by the way, when he said Benjamin Shelton. Like he broke into fucking WWE offices in Connecticut and went through the filing cabinet, and that's how the label read. It was Benjamin, Shelton. Fucking idiot. Good on Shelton Benjamin for speaking up. The only reason I'm including it in said tweet is because this whole situation is sad, and it has nothing to do with Shelton Benjamin. Some quick AEW notes. We still don't know anything regarding Double or Nothing, which is coming up on May 25th, beyond the two Owen Hart matches that we know are scheduled for that show, the two finals. They had a women's four-way eliminator match. It's been eliminators galore lately on AEW television. We had another one on Wednesday. It was won by Toni Storm. So they didn't even use it to crown a number one contender for her championship. They had her in the four-way, and she won. Okay. Now, Megan Bain made an appearance. She interfered. She didn't really interact with Tony, though. So I don't know if they're planning on another match between her and Bain, or maybe something with Bain and Penelope Ford against Tony, almost like either a triple threat or a handicap-type situation. If they're going to run it back, I think Penelope Ford should be in there. Honestly, she was the one who impressed the most in that four-way. Tony kind of took a step back in that match and let the other girls shine because it was Thunder Rosa, Penelope Ford, and Anna Jay. And like I said, Tony came out the winner. And then there was another eliminator match on the same show where Okada got a win over Kevin Knight. So no luck there as far as a new number one contender, although I would expect that Okada is probably going to end up in the Anarchy in the Arena match if there is one. I'm assuming there will be one at Double or Nothing. So right now it's still just the two Owen Hart tournament matches, Will Ospreay against Hangman Adam Page, which I think is going to be fucking awesome, and Mercedes Moné against Jamie Hayter, which also has the chance to be very, very good at the very least, if not great. I have high hopes that Jamie Hayter is starting to get back some of that aura that she's been missing since she came back to this company. But I don't know about the whole... Everyone talks about the Scooby-Doo look. It's a very weird choice on her part. She can dress whatever way she wants to dress, but I do miss the Jamie Hayter of old. Now, speaking of Mercedes, she actually lost. People are like, oh, she never loses. Well, she did. She just lost her Strong Women's Championship. Her reign has come to an end Although she did not take the losing fall in the match, it was Azumi winning the championship, defeating Mercedes and Mina Shirakawa in the main event of New Japan's Resurgence show. And the finish had Shirakawa throwing Mercedes out of the ring. As Azumi gained the advantage, it attempted several pinfall attempts, eventually succeeding and pinning Shirakawa to win the match and the title. So, you know, it's pretty lame whenever a champion loses and they don't actually get pinned to lose the title. It all depends on how it's done. Mercedes loses, but, you know, does she really lose? Technically she did, but again, she didn't take the losing fall in the match. But her run now as the Strong Women's Champion comes to an end after nearly a year. After the match, Monet, who was stunned, quickly focused her anger on Mina, blaming her for the loss. And the two of them argued as Monet then shoved Shirakawa, who fled the ring as Shirakawa chased her to the back. And in the ring, Azumi closed the show by saying that she was very happy and celebrated with the title, declaring it was now Azumi time. So Mercedes still has her other belts. She's still the TBS champion. She's the Rev Pro British Undisputed Women's Champion, which I believe is a combined title because I know that championship was merged with another one. That's why she's been walking around with four belts. So now she's got three belts, even though it's technically two championships. And look, I mean, this might be setting up something with her and Mina because Mina is coming to AEW. She's leaving Japan. She's moving to the States. She's coming to AEW. And I would suspect that this will lead to a feud or a match between them on AEW television, given what happened at the end of this match. So we shall see when we see Mina back on AEW TV. They had another segment with MJF and the Hurt Syndicate. Bobby Lashley is claiming he will finally give his answer as to whether or not MJF is in or out of the Hurt Syndicate this Wednesday on the Beach Break episode of Dynamite. And I will point out to you, you know, we just had Cedric Alexander, who was a member of the Hurt Business before they became the Hurt Syndicate in AEW. He was part of that original crew. His contract, his non-compete with WWE expired at midnight earlier this week. And we had him first in House of Glory. And when that match was over with Mike Santana on Friday night, fans in Logan Square Auditorium were chanting, "We hurt people," at Cedric Alexander. And he didn't really address it. He smiled. He didn't really address it. But I do think there's a pretty good chance that we will see Cedric Alexander making his AEW debut this Wednesday. No one's told me that. That's just, I said that on my Dynamite review. It's just common sense. I think he's coming in, whether it's Wednesday or not. I think he is coming in. But we'll see where the angle goes with MJF. Also on Beach Break this Wednesday, which thankfully is not a four-hour show. I was, you know, when I thought it was going to be four straight hours live on TBS because they're also taping, I guess they're taping Collision. But if it was going to be 4 hours, they would have advertised it as such and they didn't do that. But we have a main event inside a steel cage. Samoa Joe challenging Jon Moxley for the AEW World Championship. AEW is also going to be producing a tribute to Pro Football Hall of Famer and former WCW star Steve Mongo McMichael. As announced during this week's Collision, the tribute will air on the Saturday, May 17th episode of Collision Beach Break, airing from Chicago, because again, they're taping it on Wednesday. McMichael played 13 of his 15 NFL seasons with the Chicago Bears. Tony Schiavone announced on Thursday's telecast that McMichael's longtime friend and former Four Horsemen comrade Ric Flair will be in attendance for the tribute. McMichael passed away in April at the age of 67 after a long battle with ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, and he was inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame in August of 2024. That's more than I can say WWE did for Mongo. I mean, I know he was more of a WCW guy, but they swallowed up WCW. So it would have been very easy for them to put a graphic up or something, unless I missed it. I don't think they even acknowledged his death. You know, former WCW United States champion, member of the Four Horsemen. And actually, he was involved in WWE. He may never have wrestled for them. But back in 95, when they brought in Lawrence Taylor, he was involved in that. He was one of those fellow football players, one of his friends that were brought in. He was ringside for that main event at WrestleMania 11. So yes, he did have involvement there with WWE. In fact, there was an episode of Raw where he was doing commentary with Vince McMahon. And he would do commentary later in WCW with Eric Bischoff, but he did it first in WWE. And then later that year, he appeared on the first Nitro. So You can't say he doesn't have any history in that company. Good on AEW for paying tribute to him in a way that WWE did not. And lastly here, in an interview with Tokyo Sports, Tetsuya Naito said that he would be undergoing surgery on his left eye on May 7th, which was this past week. This was just days after he worked his final match as a full-time performer anyway for New Japan at their Wrestling Dantaku show, which sold out with over 5,000 fans in Fukuoka, their largest crowd in that city since the pandemic. And I'm sure it being Naito's last match had a lot to do with that. He also said that he will soon be starting stem cell treatment on his right knee, which he hopes will enable him to get more power in his leg. He says he is not retiring, but will be taking some time off before getting back out there. I think taking a little bit of time off to fix up a few things and then freelancing the way that Minoru Suzuki does, I think that's the smart move. Physically, he may not be in his prime anymore, you know, clearly, but Naito was still the biggest name in New Japan. He was still the biggest star they had left, and he is still very popular. LIJ was very popular, even though it's not, now it's been disbanded. They still sold a ton of merch for the company. I think Naito is someone who would kill it working the indies and make a killing and be very successful working indies and making his own schedule. I think that would be the smart play for him. Let's get to your mailbag questions. You could always email me to solomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Again, no Dark Side of the Ring review this week, even though I'm all caught up on the episodes. I have not had any time to put any thoughts or notes down. Because I've been out of town, I've just been so busy. I will be doing reviews for the Eddie Gilbert episode and the Billy Jack Haynes episode that aired this past week, and what a wild story that is. So they're coming. You just got to bear with me, but those reviews will be up in the near future. Jerry from San Antonio. Totally forgot that Backlash was tonight. Completely missed the show, but then again, what did I miss? Is it fair to say WWE is ice cold right now? It was on a hot streak for sure, and we were riding high, but the Cena heel turn is just a dead horse going nowhere. WrestleMania just seemed like a filler show, but if WrestleMania was just a filler show, what are we really building to, and where is all this going? I don't know. I guess I'm thinking out loud. This product, though, for sure is just officially dead in the water without a paddle. Would you not agree? No, I would not agree. I'm not going to deny that the John Cena heel turn has been pretty underwhelming, and the television coming out of WrestleMania has not been terribly exciting. I mean, I think that's a fair statement to make if that's how you feel, but the idea that, you know, WWE is ice cold and dead in the water right now, I mean, business is still booming. They still have packed houses. I mean, that certainly hasn't changed, and there are things on the show that I'm enjoying. I'm enjoying, you know, honestly, a lot of what we've been getting with the ladies. I figure the reason we're getting it is because they're gearing up for an Evolution 2 this summer, which still hasn't been announced, by the way. But, you know, we're seeing Julia and Roxanne seemingly get called up to the main roster, and Rhea now is working with Io. They're going to have that tag match tomorrow night. The stuff with Becky and Lyra, especially the match they had last night, was very, very good. I mean, there are things that you can point to on these shows. The U.S. title scene right now on SmackDown, the Rollins stuff, Rollins and Bron Breakker and Paul Heyman, still very early, but we'll see where that heel group goes. I don't agree that they're dead in the water. I think that's overstating it, that the WWE product right now is ice cold. I don't think would be an accurate way to describe the product right now. Now, you may not be enthralled with what they're doing with John Cena and some of the key stories. I think that is fair. And hopefully as we head into Money in the Bank, they have a two-night SummerSlam coming up. They're basically doing a WrestleMania now in August. So they're going to have to get all their stories, you know, their key stories and their key players lined up. And hopefully as we go into SummerSlam, the build to SummerSlam will be more exciting than the build to WrestleMania was. That's my hope. I don't know if it's going to be Highway to Hell from 98, but it would kind of be nice if it was something like that. Ray from Arlington, Texas. Peacock is trash. You get no argument out of me. I just got home, he said, and it's 2.5 hours into the show. It doesn't start from the beginning and will only go to about what did he say here? Half an hour or an hour back. So I have to sit here with a hot pizza and not watch the show so I can wait for it to end and then another 15 minutes for it to be re-uploaded so I can watch the start of the damn show. Do you watch on Netflix with your VPN? If so, which country do you pick, and can I start from the beginning like the WWE Network used to? Well, Ray's in Arlington, Texas. He's not out of the country, so I don't know why it would work differently for you. I have had that issue before on Peacock with not being able to start from the beginning, and that is bullshit. I don't know if everybody has that issue. I've definitely had that issue before. I didn't try it last night, but that is fucking garbage, and there's just no reason for that. So I get your frustration on that. As far as watching WWE on Netflix, it's just Raw, and yeah, I use ExpressVPN, which you hear me talking about all the time here on the show. I mean, realistically, if you use any reputable VPN, obviously if you use ExpressVPN, we have a special deal going for Sound Off listeners where you get an extra 4 months free. It used to be 3 months, now it's 4 months free. And so whatever VPN you use, I would advise you to use one, because I've never had any issues starting from the beginning. I think you could do that even without a VPN. But if you have the VPN, you could avoid the commercials and you get to see all the stuff that goes on in between the commercial breaks. So that would be my recommendation to you if you're looking for one. Chris from Northern New Jersey, if Jeff Cobb shows up tonight for Backlash, does he join the Judgment Day? Obviously, this came in before Backlash. He says they have been hinting a new member and Dom needs help tonight to beat Penta. With Liv overseas, I think it might work as a legit heavy for the Judgment Day. Then we get some Lucha Underground rematch between Matanza and Pentagon Dark. Pentagon Dark is what I'm waiting to see. I just don't think we're going to get to see him anytime soon, because he's doing well enough as a babyface, and they're going to want to do that Lucha Bros reunion. You know, it's interesting that you mentioned the Judgment Day. The Judgment Day, this is not the Judgment Day of old. Okay, this is a half-hearted version of the Judgment Day, and I wouldn't be completely upset if they just disbanded the whole fucking group, honestly. So, that being said, you mentioning that, I'm not sure that wouldn't have been a better spot for Cobb, honestly. So instead of being in one group, they put him with another. It's just a matter of which group is going to get more visibility. Solo's Bloodline will get visibility on SmackDown. But the Judgment Day is still all over Raw on Monday. So in a way, it kind of feels like a lateral move. Just pick your group and he could be the heavy for either one of those groups. But I hadn't really thought about him being the new member of the Judgment Day. But that actually would have made sense. You know, they had all the Judgment Day members out there anyway, except for the women. But if Dom had to go it alone, if maybe they did a segment before the match where he told Balor and everybody, guys, I got to do this on my own, right? And everyone's like, really? Wow, Dom's actually grown a set of balls here. He doesn't want any help. And then you see the new member is Jeff Cobb. Or maybe Balor is the one who says, brother, I know you can handle Penta on your own, so we're going to hang back because I know you can beat him by yourself. I know you don't, or maybe not even that. I know you don't need us. You don't need me to help fight your battles for you. And so Dom goes out there and he has no help. And then Cobb ends up showing up and he's like, you're right. I don't need you. I have him. So that could have worked too. But honestly, in the end, he's going to end up in the same basic spot, no matter which group he ends up with. Tim from Texas. I would like to get your opinion on Tom Brady on Logan Paul's podcast, saying that Hulk Hogan is the greatest WWE wrestler of all time. People online are losing their minds over this. Well, I mean, it wouldn't be wrestling Twitter. It wouldn't be Twitter, period, if people were losing their minds over something. They always find something to be upset about. That's his opinion, and I think that's perfectly fine. I mean, I don't know what his frame of reference is as far as wrestling. I grew up a Hulk Hogan fan. And so Tom Brady, I don't know how into wrestling these days he is or how up on the product he even is that he would be able to name some of the top stars. So for him, I mean, Hulk Hogan is the most popular or famous, probably well-known wrestler that there ever was in this country anyway. And so maybe he was just naming somebody that he knew. I didn't see the interview, so I don't know how it came up, if Logan asked him the question or if he brought it up himself, but I mean, that's fine. That's his opinion. There's nothing wrong with that. There's a lot of people who would agree with him and say Hulk Hogan is the greatest wrestler of all time. Wrestler is a very heavy word because wrestler can mean so many different things. I think if you're looking at it strictly as like in-ring performer bell to bell, Yes, a lot of people are going to disagree and freak out over it because Hulk Hogan will not be mistaken as the greatest mat technician that ever existed. But as far as just like the greatest wrestler, greatest superstar, yeah, Hogan's in the conversation. You can't, whatever you think of Hulk Hogan as a person, or whatever you think of what Hulk Hogan has said or done to sully his legacy over the last 10 or 15 years, and he's done a lot of stupid shit, okay? And Lord knows I've talked about it. I talk about it almost weekly now because he's always in the news. But I can also sit here and tell you that, yes, without Hulk Hogan, WWE would not be what it is today. He came along at just the right time. That partnership with him and Vince McMahon, the timing was right for them to blow it up and expand and go national and put everybody else out of business. And Hogan just had the charisma that worked. He didn't have to be the greatest in-ring worker. He was out there. He was doing interviews. He was cutting those insane, probably coked up promos. And he just had a certain charisma about him that made him very magnetic. And he brought in a lot of new fans. I was one of those fans. Would I have become a wrestling fan anyway? Probably. But I can't say for sure, right? My father and my grandfather were wrestling fans. And that was before Hogan was a thing. So I would like to think that even if Hogan wasn't, you know, as popular as he was at the time that I was growing up, I would have become a wrestling fan regardless. But I don't know that, right? There's a lot of people that probably would not be wrestling fans right now were it not for Hulkamania, brother, you know, and Hogan body slamming Andre, who then died 5 days later. So you can't deny Hogan's place in history. I don't give a shit what you think of the guy. You know, Hogan will always be in that conversation. You have a Mount Rushmore, like a WWE Mount Rushmore. He's on Mount Rushmore. You could try to, you know, etch over him with somebody else. You could try to kind of cut out his part of the mountain and remove it if you want to. He's on that Mount Rushmore. You know, whatever the other names are on there, if you want to put, you know, Austin on there or Cena or Bruno or Andre or whatever, you know, he's in that conversation. So I'm not surprised that Tom Brady would say that. I don't, like I said, know what his frame of reference is in the first place when it comes to wrestling, but okay. I mean, I don't know why people would be bothered by this. Are they trying to cancel Tom Brady now because he said Hulk Hogan was the greatest wrestler of all time? I mean, is this what we've come to? Kennedy from Orlando. I have an idea on how to elevate the two mid-card women's titles in WWE. The Raw IC women's title should be put on Rhea Ripley and let her do an open challenge. Since WWE has relationships with a lot of places, they can bring women in from TNA, from Pro Wrestling NOAH, AAA, and NXT to face her. Since Charlotte is treated like she's a heel, WWE should lean into it and have her win the SmackDown US title just because she wants to piss the fans off. You can have her hold the title hostage and be smug about it. That way, when the time is right and they lose both belts, the girls that beat them will get the rub. What do you think? This is kind of similar to what I was talking about earlier, where having Becky hold the IC or having Charlotte hold the US, like, I'm not against it. I just don't want to see it at the same time. So like here, I wouldn't have Rhea with the IC title and Charlotte with the US title at the same time, like holding it hostage. I wouldn't do that. Rhea as the Intercontinental Champion and doing an open challenge gimmick, I mean, it worked for John Cena when he was the US champion. That was fun. But the difference is it was something that was used to try to elevate names that were on the WWE roster. I don't like the idea that she's going to win the title and she's going to do an open challenge and bring in women from all of these other places, because how do you think that's going to make people like Lyra Valkyria feel? How do you think that's going to make any of these other women on the roster who these titles were designed for in the first place? How is that going to make them feel if they're now being overlooked to bring in women from other companies that don't even work here to wrestle Rhea Ripley and look good and have great matches? It defeats the entire purpose of even having these titles in the first place. So I don't like that idea, because I feel like you're just handicapping your own roster. You're basically spitting in their face. I wouldn't do that. Dak from St. Paul, Minnesota. I want to get your thoughts on Mariah May possibly going to WWE. I think it could end up being a mistake because of how loaded the women's roster is. It's getting congested fast, and I feel like she could get lost in the shuffle. On the main roster alone, you have Becky and Charlotte, Bayley, Io, Rhea, Bianca, Jade, Julia, Roxanne, Tiffany, Nia, Alexa, and Naomi, kind of filling out their main event scene. An upper mid-card with Lyra seemingly on the way, with Stephanie Vaquer likely being called up soon and Jordan Grace not far behind her. It seems like on the main roster, Mariah could get lost. I think NXT should be the main focus, or could be a main focus, but she can't be there forever. Also, do you think having three blondes with similar gimmicks, Charlotte, Tiffany, and Mariah, could cause issues with her connecting with WWE fans? Maybe a bit of a, we already have this character response from the audience. No, I don't think that people are going to have any issue when they lay eyes on Mariah May and they realize how, I talked about charisma, right, with Hogan. It's not that she's just a beautiful woman, which she is, and she has that sex appeal, and they're going to market the shit out of this woman. She's very photogenic, okay? You're going to see her all over the place. But she can work. She can work her ass off, and she can talk, and she does have a very charismatic personality. All of that is going to work to her advantage, and she's going to do very well. Nobody is going to take one look at Mariah May if she debuts and go, oh, man, we already have Tiffany. We already have we don't need this woman on our television screen. Like, nobody is going to say that. Nobody is going. Maybe some of the other women on the roster might say that. They may not want her there because they feel it would be to their detriment if she joins the company. But I think Mariah May, I see your point. There are a lot of names in the division right now, and there are names that are going to be coming up from NXT, and so where does she fit? If you were to tell me that the best place for her initially would be NXT, as some of these names leave NXT, I wouldn't disagree with you on that. She doesn't need to be in NXT, but it might end up being the best place for her to debut, because then she could be the queen bee. You know, she could be the face of NXT if, let's say, Stephanie moves up and or Jordan, and it's not like they don't have other women that, you know, Mariah could work with. Let her spend some time there. Let her have a run as the NXT Women's Champion, like Stephanie has right now. And then, you know, whatever it is, 6 months later, a year later, because she's still very young, you call her up to the main roster wherever you need her. That might be the way to go. But do I think signing with WWE for her, if that's what she does, is going to be a mistake? Not in the least. Yeah, I mean, in AEW, if she resigns and Tony Khan puts her right back on TV, sure, she'll have, you know, television time. She'll be at the top or near the top of that division. Mina, her friend, is coming in so she could do stuff with Mina. And who's to say that she won't sign one more deal with AEW? Maybe this is all just a negotiating tactic on her part to drive up her value, right? Which would be good business. I'm not worried about her going to WWE. I'm not worried in the least. She's going to be fine. Angel from Los Angeles. In today's pro wrestling world, the kickouts from finishers, finisher spam, spamming near falls after a huge spot is pretty commonplace. I remember being conditioned as a kid watching Raw. John Cena would hit the AA on someone, and that was the end of the match. They only needed one finisher to win. In 2005, matches to have people kick out from finishers more than twice and spam near falls became a big deal. It's like every wrestler gets two or three resiliencies from the 2K games. When do you think this started to become the norm? I think it started to become the norm more in the late 2000s, early 2010s. But it was a thing long before. It may not have been the norm, but it was a thing long before that. I mean, dude, it goes back to the early 90s, at least, that I can remember. You know, first of all, Hogan would kick out of everybody's finish, right? Warrior did that. So it was usually reserved for like the top guy at the time. They would no-sell. Hogan did it his whole fucking career. I mean, Vader would give him a power bomb in WCW and he would pop right back up. You know, Savage would drop the elbow on him. He would get right back up. Undertaker would drop him for the tombstone. He would get right back up, except that one time when he didn't, because you got me, brother. But outside of that, Hogan made a career out of doing shit like that. And even like Undertaker and Kane, when they feuded like in the late 90s and it took multiple tombstones to put Kane away, and like you could find examples of it. Even like through the Attitude Era and into the Ruthless Aggression Era, it's not like it never happened. But it's become a real issue. And I would say it became the norm late 2000s, early 2010s would be my answer. And you know what? I think the key match was at least like mainstream, because really what I blame for that, I think it really, honestly, I mean, it comes out of the independent scene and the rise of like PWG and promotions like that. It was a different style. And you really started to see a lot of that, I think, during that period. And that's what caught fire and ultimately became the norm in wrestling. It comes from that indie style. But you go back to Undertaker and Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania 25 as like major matches go. That match was filled with that type of stuff. But they did it in a way where, to me anyway, and I complain about that sometimes, but to me, it didn't take away from the match. It just added to the match, the way that they did it. And maybe it was because the streak was on the line, and so you had the drama of the streak, and you wanted to have those dramatic near falls and kickouts. It worked. But they did a lot of that in that match. And there are people that will look at that match as the greatest WrestleMania match of all time, as maybe the greatest match of all time in WWE. Like, it's in that conversation. And so what happens when you have a match like that that's so influential? Savage and Steamboat is another example. Shawn Michaels and Razor Ramon, the ladder match. Look what happened after that. How many guys grew up watching wrestling or were young and were watching when Shawn and Razor had that first ladder match? And then they became a wrestler and they said, hey, I want to do that, but we got to do it even bigger than they did. So instead of having one ladder in the match, now we have three ladders in the match. And now we have a tag team ladder match. And now we have to do crazy dives and all this wacky shit that is just increasingly dangerous. But we have to keep upping the ante here because we can't keep doing the same stuff that those guys were doing 5 years ago. So what can we do to top it and raise the bar? So it's the same thing here where you have a match like Undertaker and Shawn Michaels, just using that as an example. And there's a lot of people watching that going, man, you know, we got to start doing that in our matches, because look at the crowd, man. They're popping off. Right? The crowd is really responding to this, and this is exciting stuff. And so we have to start doing it. So now it's no longer just the top guys doing it. It's no longer just Shawn Michaels or The Undertaker doing it. Now every fucking buddy is doing it. And that's what happens. And the more you see something, the less you want to see it, because now it's just nonstop, constant. You see it in every single match. Constant kickouts and this finisher spam. Cena at this point can't do much more than that, so he's going to rely on that more and more. We're going to see him doing 5 attitude adjustments in a match. I mean, he was doing that over 10 years ago. We're going to see that even more now, because some people just lean into it. They rely on it because there's maybe not much more that they can do. I hate it. I hate how it just has the proliferation of it is what I hate. I think in certain instances it's fine. But the overexposure of it and doing it to death every single week, almost every single match, finishers, it just, they don't mean what they used to. You know, the more that you do something, it means less and less. You could say that about anything. It's one of the reasons why I hated when Raw moved to 3 hours and SmackDown went to 3 hours. The more that you give people something and you kind of overdo, you overstep, the less they want to see it. I mean, unless the product is just that good, which right now, like on the SmackDown side, it's not. And thank God we only have a few weeks left until SmackDown goes back to 2 hours. But that same logic you can apply to so many different things. So I like the analogy you used about the 2 or 3 resiliencies from the 2K games, because that's really what it's like. You know, it's like video game wrestling. I mean, that's really what it is. D the Wise from Syracuse, New York. I know many fans, myself included, wish that Owen Hart could have held the main WWE championship at least once. During his career, at what point would have been the best time for him to hold that title? Also, would it be transitional or long-term? It would definitely not be long-term. It would have been a transitional. I have said before that I think him winning the championship between King of the Ring and SummerSlam, even if it was like a shocking house show match win, and then Owen going into the cage match at SummerSlam defending against Brett and Brett winning it back there, you could have absolutely have done that. That really would have been the time that it would have made the most sense to put that title on Owen. And it would have been short, but you know, the company could use it as a gauge just to see how he did. And maybe he does really well. And maybe he's got a few weeks there defending the title on live events and the gates go up and they're like, huh, okay, maybe this could be something a little longer term. But that's what I would have done. You know, I would have flipped the belt. I'm sure Brett wouldn't have had an issue doing that, you know, dropping it to his brother, and then have Owen defend against Brett, and Brett just regains the belt back. I don't see the harm in doing that, but that would have been the time to do it. And finally here, David, our friend David from Sacramento, California, is back with another Be the Booker supercard. He's calling it Solo Mania 2025. So David does this every few months where he will keep a running log of the various matches I book in the Be the Booker segments at the end of our YouTube streams. And he will compile a poll, and I have you guys vote in the live chat on the poll. And then he tallies up the results. And so what I have here are the results from David. He says below is night two of this event. Let me rephrase that. Below is the two-night lineup, including percentages. Some results needed a tie-breaking vote, but I feel I have evened everything out. The challenge at hand is for you, buy or sell on which night you prefer to buy a ticket to. So let's take a look here real quick. Night one, main event with almost 34% of the vote for the Be the Booker Tag Team Championship, Stone Cold Steve Austin and Dude Love against the Rock and Sock Connection. I mean, I know Foley had three faces, but so that's something else. Him being on opposite sides of the match here is very interesting. But hell of a match. 26.7% steel cage match. Bo Dallas against The Fiend, Bray Wyatt. 22.5%. What he calls the Hardy the Workhorse Championship. Razor Ramon against Sami Zayn. Yeah, I remember booking that match. That'd be a hell of a match too. 16.9% Women's Parking Lot Brawl. Mickie James against Jamie Hayter. 15.4% Owen Hart against Bandito. Man, that would have been fucking great. 11.2% Bam Bam Bigelow against the American Dragon Bryan Danielson. 8.4% for the World Championship, the American Nightmare Cody Rhodes against the Last Outlaw, Jeff Jarrett. So that's night one. Night two, main event with roughly 31% of the vote for the World Championship. Rey Mysterio versus Kenny Omega. 25.3% for the Mama Monster title. Timeless Toni Storm against the Man, Becky Lynch. 23.9% the Brainbusters with Bobby Heenan against the Midnight Express with Jim Cornette. 21% stretcher match, the American Nightmare Cody Rhodes against Rowdy Roddy Piper. 14% for the tag team titles hardcore match, the Hart Foundation against the world's greatest tag team of Charlie Haas and Benjamin Shelton. 12.6% Joe Hendry against Sting. And 9.8% Fatal 4-Way, Darby Allin, Roman Reigns, Mil Muertes, and Ric Flair. Well, my vote goes to night two. I don't know about you guys, but I'm picking night two, I think, is the stronger of the two nights there. He also had a quick question. At NXT Battleground, Joe Hendry will defend the TNA title against NXT's Trick Williams. Although it would be an early prediction, do you see this as the first time where these working relationships lead to someone from one company holding another's title? I do not. No, I do not. I don't see Trick Williams becoming the NXT champion. I do think at some point it's going to happen. It's just as these companies work together more and more. But I would suspect that TNA has their own plans about who's going to be the one to beat Joe Hendry for that title. And I don't think Trick Williams is going to be that guy. You know, there is a guy who is on the ascent in TNA right now, who's been killing it everywhere. And I think we'll end up as the TNA World Heavyweight Champion. And that man is Mike Santana. I don't know when it's going to happen, but I think it's got to happen at some point. He's really been building up quite a resume for himself. And I don't know if Joe Hendry loses it to a heel and that person ends up being a transitional champion and then it ends up on Santana. But I think when Joe Hendry's run is over, And maybe it's at a point where his contract is up and he's absolutely going to end up in WWE. But when that run comes to an end, I think Santana is the next guy. He's that next babyface that's going to be world champion in that company. I mean, he's somebody who has really worked his ass off to prove a lot of people wrong who just saw him as nothing more than a tag team guy. Like, there were people who put a ceiling on him And you could tell he's got a chip on his shoulder. He's been out now for well over a year to prove a lot of people wrong. And he's been doing that. So that would be my prediction. Not a spoiler, but a prediction there for what's to come in the future. But I don't think Trick Williams is going to be that guy to beat Joe Hendry. But good questions. Thank you, David, for all your hard work. And everybody else, keep emailing me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Of course, you can catch me live on the Solemn Monster Sounds Of YouTube channel each and every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday when I am not otherwise occupied with another show. And Tuesday nights, over on JD from NY's channel, we do a little show called Tuesday Night Titans, which has been killing it. I just had my one-year anniversary, and we're heading very quickly towards episode 100. We got 95 coming up this week. So we're a little over a month away from episode 100. Time flies, man. I'm telling you, I can remember joining the show about a year ago. And all of a sudden, here we are, beginning year two. So wherever you catch me, I appreciate all the support and you guys following me. And again, those of you who I saw at the House of Glory show on Friday, thank you very much. I just want to say here at the very end, again, this is another Mother's Day episode. I pay tribute to my mom on the show every year. You hear it in the intro. And I just want to wish her a happy Mother's Day. Even though she is no longer with us, she is very much missed. Not a day goes by that that woman is not missed. And a very happy Mother's Day to all the moms out there who may be listening to this right now. Be well, stay safe, and I will see you back here next weekend for episode 913. Of the Solemonster Sounds Off. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solemonster Sounds Off.
Not only did Powerhouse Hobbs not win the AEW World Championship tonight, which is no surprise, but they actually destroyed his leg. And right after they stomped on the fucking chair, you think you know me. And here comes Adam Copeland and FTR, who were standing there at the go position, just waiting for their cue, watching, I'm sure, on a monitor as this man was maimed by the Death Riders. Can't go out there without my music.
I need my music right now. Come on, man.
As soon as they hit the music, out they came. See, now, if I'm Powerhouse Hobbs, when I come back from this injury, I'm going after Cope and Bald and Hair for not coming out and saving me here in this spot, for being a couple of selfish, spineless assholes.
Where's the fucking music?
We can't go anywhere until the music hits, so let's let this poor fucker get his leg destroyed first, and then we'll run after.
Please, for the love of fucking God, put the music on.
That's who Hobbs ought to go after. Very, very stupid.
The Solemonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007.
Bringing you the good,
the bad,
and the ugly. Check out the weekly live streams, bonus content for subscribers, and follow The Solemonster on Facebook, Instagram, and X. The Solemonster.
I love you so long.